Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, our good friend Erwin Aronson, super attorney Erwin Aronson, going to be here talking about the National Labor Relations Board information and how the right has completely blown a gasket. Is this worth it? Is this something that the right should be blowing a gasket over? We'll talk to him about that. Also, the budget. Some contract negotiations going on with the state workers. We'll find out a little bit about that from Erwin. Also in the second hour, SEIU 668 member Ken Jasper going to be here filling us in on some of the details of the negotiations. We'll find out what's going on there. And also in the second hour, Eric Loomis of the blog Lawyers, Guns, and Money going to be here talking also about the NLRB stuff. Because, you know, look, the right has completely blown a gasket. I don't know if you've been paying attention to this. And the reality is these are really very, very minor, rational, common sense moves. Securing the right of people to vote. The right was screaming about that. Oh, and we were talking about the Employee Free Choice Act. You're stealing my right to the secret ballot. They even brought Joe, the unlicensed plumber, here to Harrisburg, had a ballot box, had a big, you know, shower curtain. You could go in and cast your ballot. The problem is they wouldn't let anybody vote. Again, it's their ballot. And what you take away from all of this, right, the lesson that's in all of this, and we're going to talk about it a great deal tonight because I think it's important, but the lesson that's here is they're not against the secret ballot. They're not against elections. They're not against the NLRB when it benefits corporations, when it benefits them, when it's done on their timetable, when it's done at their behest. They're not against it at all. And you look at the very commonsensical moves that the NLRB said, you know what, we need to update this a little bit. Just a little bit. Get rid of some of the excessive delays. Get rid of the time-consuming litigation that costs everybody money. And understand, corporations love the court process. They love taking unions to court because, you know why? Makes them expel resources. Makes them spend that money on attorneys. Because companies don't run out of money. They'll generate, then write it off, and you and I pay for it anyway. And, you know, you look at this, and the right's been, I don't know if you've seen anything positive, because I haven't. All the news that I've seen has been very, very negative. Oh, the NLRB is going to take over the country, and we should, you know, we should do away with it. We should repeal the whole thing. And you're not seeing anything coming out saying, well, wait a second, what do these guys want to do? What they want to do is they want to streamline the process so that it's fair. It's fair for workers, it's fair for employers, it's fair for taxpayers. What our captains of industry, what the CEO class wants is the status quo. They're very happy taking years for elections to happen and years for first contracts to happen. You know, I keep thinking of that Smithfield fight down in, I think it was North Carolina, 17 years. You could have retired from that company before they got a contract. And yet the rights keep saying, you know what, that's how it should be. The corporatists of the country are very happy the way things are because they've got us divided. And they know if you make it to where they don't have time to harass and intimidate, they don't have time to scare the hell out of you, maybe you're going to stand together. And maybe if you had a process in place that says, you know what, we're going to streamline this, people are going to have time to sit down, discuss, have a first contract move forward so everyone benefits. They don't want that, man. They like it the way it is. They don't want a middle class that's growing and expanding. They're happy with the desperation class. They're happy with people who have to show up to work every single day and beg for overtime because they can't make their bills now. Very, very happy. And understand that the people who are against this, this whole push to repeal the National Labor Relations Board, repeal the Wagner Act, repeal the Railway Act, repeal all the labor laws. These are people who do this purely for political reasons. Not because it's good for you, not because it's good for me. And what's amazing is how systematic these attacks are. And the fact that they're nationwide should show you that they are. They're well constructed, they're well put together, they're well funded, well organized. This isn't about a handful of rogue governors who just got a bug up their craw one day and said, you know what? Think I'm going after those teachers. Think I'm going after those public sector workers. No. This is stuff that has been planted and cultivated and has grown for 30, 35, 40 years. This is their wet dream. This is it. This is everything that they've ever wanted balled up in one nice, neat package. And the one thing that the corporatists understand is that you, the worker, you are the problem. You and me, you're the problem. Your rights are the problem. If you were to demand your rights, I mean, stop and think about all of this discussion that's going on. Stop and think about it for a minute. It's all about how to make it harder for you to stand together. And how to make it easier for corporations to subvert the law. I mean, you look at the Boeing case. It's not about South Carolina, even though they've made it about South Carolina. It's about a company who has chosen to, in public, break the law. And then when we have someone who decides to hold them accountable, and part of me thinks this has been 30 years of the NLRB not enforcing their own laws. This has been 30 years of them doing what the corporations have wanted, keeping industrial peace, making the employers happy. That's what this is about. Finally, someone has said, wait a second, you've really now gone too far. You're way out of bounds. We got to bring you back. And that's what this is about. And, you know, I guess it's been... And that's where I'm at with this. I think it's been so long since someone has enforced the laws. I think it's been so long since someone said no to corporate America that we're all kind of shocked, that we're all kind of sitting back going, well, gee, I didn't know. And part of me says that, you know, the bigger part of this, the bigger problem is that we do not know. We don't even know what our rights are anymore. Most people, you know, I've asked a couple people the last day or so, you know, what's the NLRB stand for? Are you happy with the decision? Do you know what they did? And to a person, every one of them didn't know what NLRB stood for, but knew they had heard they were against it. They knew what they had heard was negative. And this is because we have a mainstream corporate-controlled media in this country who are basically union busters themselves putting out the message. And I'm just amazed, absolutely amazed, that we would take this sitting down and that working people would, would just kind of follow along. And I guess it takes me, Jake, back to the whole, my whole premise of Stockholm Syndrome and folks having been beat for generations and just not knowing what they don't know.
And again, we're being out organized, the right wing with their millionaire and billionaire backers. They have these think tanks, and the think tanks then sent their message out to politicians and sister organizations, and they are in sync. I've seen it 100 times. They are in sync. They are well organized, and they have their message down. That's why they're winning the propaganda battle.
And at the end of the day, you know, I hesitate, and I shudder to think, what happens if we allow the right to move on this, and you start seeing massive blowback, you start seeing people going after these groups and saying, you know what, we're gonna do away with it. There's part of me, the purist in me, says, you know what, do away with all of those. Take the NLRB away. Undo the Wagner Act. Take all that stuff. The Rail Act. So we can shut this country down. So that when the air traffic controllers say, you know what? Going on strike. The pilots say, going on strike. Truck drivers say, going on strike. There are no laws pushing them back to work. The sad thing about it is I don't know that we have that kind of solidarity in this country. I don't know that we would stand together. And maybe we would turn into your basic second-rate country. Because what's really worrying me is you look at the Chinese. They've got that we're going to be the next superpower mentality. We're going to build our country up. We're going to take command of manufacturing. We're going to protect ourselves. Here, we seem to be all about ourselves. Just me, the individual, not the nation. You know, and I listen to the right, they keep pushing out that, oh, you're the individual, it's all about you, but oh, hey, we got to fight back against those evil liberals. It's kind of a bizarre, twisted message. But it's one that they've done a nice job of putting out there. It's all about me. Without ever thinking how that type of thought process tears us all down. Scary stuff. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. We're right back after this. We're in a fight to bring the middle class back. And we ain't even planning on losing in this fight. The working class is under attack. Get up, fight on. Stand up, fight on. Yes, we can fight on. To the death, fight on. Get up, fight on.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Last weekend, the Workers' Independent News traveled to Netroots Nation. This year, the main focus was on organized labor, sparked mostly by the uprising in the state of Wisconsin. Nearly every panel we attended mentioned the Wisconsin moment and how it has sent waves of inspiration through the country and has changed the way progressive organizations and labor unions fight their battles. Van Jones was one of the keynote speakers of the event. He said one of the lessons he's learned from both the Tea Party and the spontaneous action in Wisconsin is that there is no more room for single, charismatic leaders. Instead, organizations need to unite and focus on charismatic networks.
That's the genius of the Tea Party. They have charismatic leaders of a certain kind. But if Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck and Dick Armey had a press conference tomorrow and said the Tea Party is over, it wouldn't be over because the values and the network wouldn't let it.
Peggy Mears is a member of the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, an organization that formed to help homeowners struggling with foreclosure to take on the banks. Mears spoke on a panel called The Empire Strikes Back, The Fate of Wall Street Reform. And she tapped into the inspiration she's felt in her state from what she witnessed happen in Wisconsin.
Wall Street bankers and Republicans with their deregulation mentality is the cause of the financial crisis. You will not put that on teachers. You will not put that on our public workers such as police and firefighters. We're not going to have it. We're standing with Wisconsin.
On Friday, four buses of online activists traveled to the Minneapolis Stone Arch Bridge, which stands in the view of the I-35 bridge that collapsed 4 years ago. There, the laborers were holding a rally to push for investment in the nation's eroding infrastructure. Terrell Clark of the Blue-Green Alliance said that infrastructure doesn't simply mean roads and bridges.
We want to make sure that we can continue to have safe and clean drinking water. We need to make those investments now, create those good jobs, and make sure that we're moving forward. Every day, 7 billion gallons of clean drinking water are lost to leaking pipes.
Laborers President Terrence O'Sullivan also spoke on the bridge, and he pushed the message spread 2 miles away in the convention center.
Let us fight together and let us win together, not only for infrastructure, but let's be radical in our approach. We need to be radical when it comes to the fight for workers' rights, for human rights, for civil rights, for infrastructure jobs, and the right to put people back to work again. And I know that we will do it. So let us stand together, let us fight together, and let us win together.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therichsmithshow.com. Now, like I said, the right's kind of blowing a gasket over this NLRB thing. The National Review ran a piece by a guy named Kevin Williamson. He writes, one thing to add to today's editorial on the National Labor Relations Board, which is looking to change union election rules to tilt the game to further favor big labor. There are two main ways to harm enterprise, he writes. One through regulation. You have one, which is to have bad, erroneous regulations. The other is to have regulations that are always changing. And in this case, we have both erroneous regulations that are always changing. And you know, which is kind of odd, because the last time there was any change to the NLRB, oddly enough, today, 64 years ago, when a Republican Congress overrode President Harry Truman's veto of the anti-worker Taft-Hartley, you know, constantly changing, you know, once every 64 years. Amazing stuff. Anyway, here to help us work a little bit through this, our good friend and newly named super attorney, our friend Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for letting me be here and... promise me that you're not going to do any more of that super attorney stuff, and I'll keep talking.
I just saw that. Hey, that's a wonderful honor. It's a good thing.
Well, it's a wonderful recognition from my peers, but in the end, this is all about fighting the fight to protect working people from the avarice of the rest of the world. And if in that context, a couple of people recognize that every now and again, I try to accomplish something in that direction, that's nice, but there's nothing super about this. What would be super would be the day that came that workers didn't need to have lawyers at all to protect their fundamental rights that are guaranteed to them by federal law and the Constitution of the United States. If I was made irrelevant, that would be a super day.
Well, let's talk about this because, you know, you've got these people out there, and I think the right is completely blowing a gasket over this. And as I'm seeing them, they're very modest changes, really not changes at all, just kind of streamlining things.
Well, candidly, they're not changes at all. Candidly, the right is wrong. And most importantly, as a practitioner who works with this particular statutory framework an awful lot, there's something that needs to be said and made clear beyond peradventure. Unlike most of the people who are commenting on this terrible thing that the Labor Board has suggested, I've actually read that statute. Indeed, I've read it many times. And you know, there's not a section in that law. There's not a paragraph in that law. There's not a sentence in that law. There's not a phrase in that law. There's not a word in that law that confers any rights on employers. This is a law that talks about the right of workers to organize and bargain collectively with their employers over wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment. Every so-called right that the right wing is now flailing about over and blowing their gaskets over is a right that was imposed on the law and engrafted onto it by a judge, most likely a judge that was appointed by one of them. The fact of the matter is this is the law for workers, and the employers have, since 1935, and particularly since that 1947 date that you just mentioned, perverted this law to give and arrogate to themselves rights that were never contemplated by the Congress of the United States, rights to delay elections, rights to twist people around, rights to secure a ridiculous, unfair advantage by having things be fuzzy and imprecise and unclear, by giving them opportunities to manipulate workers who have made clear their intentions to vote up or down about whether or not they want to have a union, and to delay their exercise of their franchise. Now, last year, when we were talking about the possibility of the passage of the Employee Free Choice Act, these same wing nuts were yelling and screaming and carrying on that that would be terrible because it was taking away the secret ballot. Well, damn, if they're so committed to elections and secret ballots, why do they want to object to this very modest regulation that merely says that when a petition is filed, that there's going to be a clear and fair election process that will improve stability, reduce confrontation in the workplace? The current NLRB process creates often a protracted, drawn-out legal maneuvering that damages labor relations, hurts productivity, impairs safety, disrupts commerce in the United States, all in violation of the intent of the National Labor Relations Act. And all this seeks to do is to make what the Congress said in 1935 happen finally. And not in any kind of radical way, by the way, but in a limited, narrow, focused way.
Let me ask you this, Erwin, and looking at this, and, you know, the same thing with Boeing, looking at these modest changes, how much of it do you think is that we just don't know what the law is, and it has been so long since the Labor Relations Board, the National Labor Relations Board, has sided with workers? For me, you know, most of my working life, they've always made decisions with business in mind before workers, in my opinion.
Well, I think that you're quite right, and it's not that we don't understand the law. We do understand the law. What we don't understand is these wild, scatterbrained interpretations that create rights for employers to thwart the will of workers out of whole cloth without any verbiage in the statute upon which anybody could rely, and they have, through judicial interpretation and activist judicial imposition in this statute, they have made the predictable unpredictable. They have made the congressional intent twisted, and as I said earlier, perverted. The current system, even Human Rights Watch has concluded, makes it possible to drag out legal proceedings for years, sometimes decades, all at the expense of workers' rights. That's not what the National Labor Relations Act was passed for. That's not what Senator Wagner had in mind when he proposed the Wagner Act that became the National Labor Relations Act. This is just going to reduce choke points in the current system, cut back on unnecessary and costly litigation, allow elections to proceed to determine whether or not workers actually want to have a union. And if there are flaws or disagreements, if you will, about who ought to be in and not in the bargaining unit once the election takes place, that'll be sorted out afterwards instead of telling people that until we deal to the nth degree of these hocus-pocus legal conundrums that employers and their fancy, you know, silk-stocking lawyers are able to create and manufacture, we'll have the election take place, we'll know the outcome, and then we'll determine these other things afterwards. The pursuit of claims that are irrelevant or found to be without merit won't stop an election from happening.
Right. You know, some of the information that we've been watching on the Twitters and people, telling us, you know, you look at the Smithfield case, 17 years it took those workers to get their rights. One of the things that we saw, I think it was SEIU asked people to send in, positive statements to the NLRB. Some 10,000 people responded. More than 2,000, almost 2,000 of them said that they had endured, threats, intimidation, a lot of the stuff that the NLRB is supposed to deal with. And it shows to me just how broken the system has become.
Well, you know, anybody who reads the history of the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB that the act creates, reads a story about how this statute was created and the board created under it to assure that there would be laboratory conditions in the conduct of these kinds of elections. And we have anything but. Our research shows that delay tactics that are imposed by employers and their lawyers who pursue these irrelevant and meritless claims work. When employers pursue litigations, elections occur on average 124 days after an election petition was filed. Can you imagine what the reaction would be if we did that in the context of our public elections? These things last longer than American presidential campaigns.
Yep.
The current lengthy protracted election process just sacrifices workers' interests and workers' rights in having an election and instead promotes coercive and illegal activity on the part of employers. We know statistically that during organizing campaigns, more than a third of companies, employers, whose employees want to have an election, fire pro-union workers. The longer an election is delayed, the more likely it is that the NLRB will charge employers with illegal misconduct. That doesn't help anybody. It certainly doesn't help the workers who just wanted to have an election and have a chance to express their voice. But it doesn't help employers either in the stream of commerce. Companies will still be, under this regulatory proposal, free to express their opinion about union representation. And I would suggest to you that that freedom comes in contravention of the law, but they'd have that right anyway. And it's very coercive. From the first day workers are hired, everybody needs to understand, companies, employers have full access and tremendous, unbridled opportunity to make their views clear to workers. In fact, nearly half the charges of illegal conduct filed with the National Labor Relations Board during organizing campaigns involve employer misconduct that took place before workers filed a petition. Not before they had an election, but before they even filed a petition to seek an election.
You know, again, you bring up an interesting point that the employers have all this access. If they just treated their employees decently, because as most people know, people seek protection, people seek organizing opportunities mainly because of conditions.
Absolutely. Long before I was a lawyer, I was a union organizer. And some might even say a relatively successful organizer, but I never was named a super organizer. They named me a super lawyer. But I will tell you candidly, and now everybody who listens to your show is going to hear this, I never once organized a union. Employers organized unions. I just showed up with authorization cards. And that's the truth. Because employers cause unions to exist, give rise to a need for unions to exist, by maltreating and mistreating people at every step of the way at their workplace. Because all people want to do is have a chance to go to work, earn a living, give eight for eight, and move along. During organizing campaigns, employers gum up the works. They manufacture charges. They fire people. They discipline people. They dismiss people. They coerce people. They scare their coworkers by implying that if you support the union, you're going to be next. And this proposed regulation just compresses that time enough that some of that hanky-panky will be stopped. And the suggestion that employers who have unfettered access to workers from the day the workers are hired are somehow being compromised now by the labor board suggesting that the purposes of the act would be enforced at some small level, not by expediting elections, but just by having elections that are not bogged down through manipulated legal processes. There's a whole lot of crocodile tears as far as I'm concerned, and as far as any thinking person should be concerned.
Let me ask you a last question I've got on this. You know, there's been a cry on the right that, you know, now they've just gone too far. They've outlived their usefulness. We need to get rid of them. We need to dissolve the NLRB, repeal the Wagner Act, repeal the Railway Act, do away with all that because they're just too difficult to deal with and too onerous on business. What are your thoughts of that?
Well, Being very candid, for many years I have suggested that the best thing for unions in the United States would be a repeal of the Wagner Act, a repeal of the National Labor Relations Act, and a repeal of the Real Labor Act, too. All they are, have been used for in the last 70-plus years has been as a club to beat us down, to take away our capacity. Everyone needs to understand that the passage of the Rail Labor Act in 1922 and the passage of the Wagner Act in 1935 were a response to labor activism that had already taken place at the workplace. Yes, it confers rights upon working people in each case of those two laws, but it also has served to confer rights on employers where they had none. Legal rights, rights to be in court, rights to file charges, rights to use all means of nefarious schemes and plans to thwart elections and election processes. Back in the day, you know, when it was time to organize the rubber industry, the auto industry, people inside the plant sat down, and when the union was recognized by the employer, they went back to work. We didn't have the niceties of labor board hearings and elections and challenges and lengthy campaigns and consultants to manipulate the outcome of union representation elections. We had people engaging in direct actions. Now they would tell us that would be an unfair labor practice.
Exactly
people
what I...
People asserting their rights, somehow, rights that we think that the Constitution and the law guarantees to them, are engaged in unfair labor practices. Imagine.
Interesting. Kind of the position I took earlier, you know, one of the positions that I have, because there's part of me that says we need to get that back, where people are directly involved in the process.
Yep.
Excellent.
We need to have more worker rights and less lawyer activity, in all due respect. And that may shake my colleagues and those who are my peers in their boots, but the fact of the matter is that this legal framework, this statutory framework, wasn't created to be full employment for lawyers. It was created to give workers a channel by which to express their rights and carry out their decisions without interference from employers or the government or anybody else.
Excellent points. And I know you look at this, and I think it's a good thing. The right's losing their mind, and that's all we keep hearing in the mainstream media, which kind of shows you where the consolidation of our media has gone and who the people are who are controlling it.
It's not often I disagree with you, but in order to lose one's mind, one must have a mind to lose.
Oh, our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, I appreciate your time, brother. Always great talking to you. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
Well, I look forward to talking to you, and hopefully by this time next week, we will know something about a budget, and we'll know something about a few other big happenings in Harrisburg under the Capitol Bill.
I can't wait. We'll see you next week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Why sing about the unions again? They have all died away. We are now in the midst of a brand new world economy. I don't believe them, I won't despair. They are regrouping, they're coming back instead. 2% can't climb back up to 50% once again.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Ah, love. A time of intimate talks, long phone calls, romantic dinners, and nonstop wooing. We can see these actions in the tender love story of Barack Obama. Not as a young man falling in love with Michelle, but as president, passionately pursuing his current heartthrob, Wall Street bankers. Obama is in hot pursuit of the elite financial royals he had once derided as fat cats. This spring, however, charmed by the heft of their bankrolls, he invited 24 of the multimillionaires over to his house. The White House, that is. Gathered in the Blue Room, they spent more than an hour with the president, who turned them on by cooing aphrodisiacal words that bankers can't resist, such as tax cuts, deregulation, and I love you. After this snuggle session, Obama followed up with personal phone calls to Wall Streeters who had not been able to attend.
Also, to demonstrate the depth of his affection for these money powers, the president is making a special trip to their private lair in New York City, taking a group of bankers, hedge fund operators, and private equity speculators to dinner at Danielle, the posh Upper West Side restaurant. Hey, nothing's too good for those you love. Excuse me, but it's embarrassing to see him kiss their sorry butts. These privileged princes of high finance crashed our economy, causing mass unemployment and hardships for millions of working-class families. Obama bailed them out, let them keep their pampered positions, and allowed them to return to their reckless casino culture. He's already done too much for them. This is Jim Hightower saying, Obama claims that he needs Wall Street's campaign cash to win re-election. But if he'd just stand up to these narcissists and stand up for America's workaday majority, he wouldn't need their money, because grassroots people would already be with him.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Just when he thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Well, you know, the reality is, if you want to live in conservative world, everything is for sale. Everything. Nothing is sacred. Nothing. Everything's up, got a price tag on it. You know, your kid's education, got a price tag on it. The roads, the bridges, our monuments, got a price tag to it. And you look in Florida, the state of Florida evidently made close to $63 million selling the residents' driver's license information. You know, that stuff that has your name, your full name, got to have a full name on it, got to have a birth date, it's got to have an address, it's got to have a driver's license number, got to have all this information. Because remember, we need to make sure that we know where you are so that you don't commit fraud while voting. So they collect all this information on your driver's license because you don't got to know who you are when you vote. And they turn around and they sell this information to 10 different corporations. And gee, you got to wonder, you know, what kind of wonderful things come out of that? You know I get phone calls all the time. I get mail. I get all kinds of stuff. You know, I got to wonder, does Pennsylvania sell our information? How much of this is going on? The ACLU attorney, a woman named Shelby Day, she told a reporter down in Florida that the sale of Florida's citizens' personal information is a violation of privacy rights, saying, I would assume that most Floridians have no idea it's even occurring. And I think that most would be deeply disturbed. And I am. I am deeply disturbed that they would sell this information. And for, you know, not a lot of money. I mean, this is over a pretty long, they're not saying how many years, but they're saying it's been a long-standing practice. So $63 million for all of your information? Are you comfortable with that? I know I'm not, but that's conservative world, man. Everything's for sale. Everyone's on the sale, man. And I look at this House Ways and Means Committee hearing that's been going on. Their chairman, a guy named Dave Camp, Republican from Michigan. He's been holding these meetings on, you know, how to reform the corporate tax rate, because we need to reform now corporate taxes. And basically their idea is to slash them from 35% down to 25%, making sure that the corporations have more profit to divvy out to the shareholders, because that's what's going to happen to it. Understand, it's not going to create more jobs. It's not going to lower the prices. It's just going to be more to hand out to the investor class. And then you find out, thanks to Bloomberg News, that Dave Camp, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, calls in these 13 CEOs of America's top corporations. Turns out he owns stock in six of them. So you kind of look at this and you go, hold on. You're calling in 13 people, telling them, you know, asking them how it would help them if you were to cut their taxes from 35 down to 25%. Six of them you own, you have a special interest in. And that's not a conflict somewhere? I mean, it's just plain nuts. And Craig Holtman, the a spokesman at the government watchdog Public Citizen, he said, look, you know, to try and pull this off, try and pull off this image of holding an impartial educational hearing and then bring in the same executives representing the companies in which you have a personal investment, that's not something I've often heard of. And me either. But again, you know, this is conservative world. It's all about how you can profit. It's all about how you're going to put some money in your pocket. And heck with everybody else. And look, you're hearing all these, we need to cut Social Security, we need to cut Medicare, we need to slash Medicaid, we need to cut. Our friend Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont, he released a 12-page report finding that some 5 million senior citizens, people like my grandmother, right now threatened by hunger in this country, 5 million senior citizens. Oh, I'm sorry, a little softer. Food insecurity. Sorry, not hunger. I don't want to upset anyone. They're not hungry. They're food insecure. Not quite sure what the difference is, but it sounds much. Doesn't it sound better? They just have food insecurity issues. That's all. In my world, when I was a kid, that meant going to the cabinet and finding nothing there. That meant opening the refrigerator and finding nothing there. I wasn't food insecure. I was hungry. I remember those days. But evidently we have become so soft that we need to, you know, we just need to protect the delicate sensibilities of some of our listeners. So those senior citizens, they're food insecure. They're not hungry. So you can sleep well tonight. Anyway, the report points out that the average cost of a meal being sent to a senior's home is about $5. The Meals on Wheels people do a great job. There's other programs that do some of this stuff. It costs about $5. And he says, you know, stop and think about this for a second. If these people don't get these nutritious meals, if they don't get fed, they have other problems. Understand that the average cost of a day in the hospital is about $1,850, he says. And to stick someone in a nursing home is, you know, close to $78,000 a year. So when you talk about that $5 a day to make sure that granny's got a nutritious meal, seems kind of cheap. Seems kind of reasonable, if you will. Now remember, under Bush, and I bring this up every time I talk about Bush and budgets because it really shows priorities. There was a program called the Community Supplemental Food Program. The Commodities Supplemental Food Program. Every month it brings a bag of groceries, you know, fresh fruits, vegetables, that kind of stuff, to Granny. Granny, if you meet a certain income level, you get these groceries. Nutritious food, not Twinkies, not mac and cheese, not stuff just to fill you up, but things to actually make sure that you meet a certain nutrition level. Every year of the Bush budget, he wanted to slash that very small program that feeds hundreds of thousands of seniors across this country at a very small price. Again, it comes back down to this idea of prevention, this idea of investing in the future. $5 a day to make sure Granny eats, or $1,870 a day to put her in the hospital, or $78,000 to keep her in a nursing home. You make the call. Now, Sanders, he's the chair of the Health Education, Labor and Pension Subcommittee, which used to be called Health Help. You know, now they've kind of changed that around a little bit. He on primary health and aging, and he calls this hearing Senior Hunger and Older American Act. And I like Sanders. I got to be honest. I think he's a good guy. You look at the reality is what the Republicans are talking about is slash and burn. Sanders is talking about, you know, how do those scorched earth policies the Republicans are pushing affect senior citizens? I mean, I don't think we can cut programs for my grandmother. I don't think Social Security, I don't think Medicare can be cut for her. She doesn't have the income. And it would kill her. And I think that would, and I'm not trying to scare people. I'm not trying to make it sound like, oh, if we cut this, they're going to die. I think they will. And I think, like Sanders says, if we invest in senior nutrition and well-designed senior programs in general, it's going to save money, It's going to save lives. It's going to keep people out of emergency rooms. It's going to keep people out of nursing homes. It's going to keep them out of the hospital. We're going to get savings. That whole investment thing, that whole looking toward the future. Remember that prevention thing that guy used to talk about with the kite? Remember the guy with the kite? You know, ounce of prevention, pound of cure. Remember him? So what do you get on this subcommittee? You get Rand Paul, who has to give his snarky remark that, well, you know, that's just Washington doublespeak. You can't save money by feeding granny. You know, never mind the improved nutrition. Never mind those regular checkups. Never mind the food safety for seniors. Never mind that. That couldn't possibly save us any money in the long run. Couldn't possibly do it. Couldn't possibly make them healthier. Couldn't possibly. But it's the scorched earth mentality, folks. It's that mentality that's going to take us down the drain. And they keep telling us all these cuts are good for us. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how good they really are for you and me. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We are right back after this.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
You helped to turn America blue. Now let's keep it that way. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, this whole thing, all of these talks that they're pushing down our throats, that we need to cut. Everything to balance the budget has to be done with cutting. And this guy Brian Connors wrote an interesting piece. He says they'll say it's for your own good, but bottom 99%, the GOP has been shafting for generations. He goes into pretty much how we got here. You go back through into the 70s when they really started pushing this idea of we need massive tax breaks for the very wealthy because, you know, they create jobs. And it's been this whole push. Nixon wouldn't do it. Ford wouldn't do it. Carter wouldn't do it. And then along came Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan said, you know what? I'll do it. I'll be happy to cut taxes on the very wealthy. Even though they knew at the time, and they did, And a lot of people said, all you're going to do is you're going to put us into debt. You're going to raise the debt. We're going to be red ink for as far as the eye can see if we do what you're proposing. He went ahead and did it anyway. Sent us right into a recession. Our debt went through the roof. Deficits as far as the eye could see. He raised taxes again and again and again, but he couldn't get it under control. So they set up this Social Security thing. Him and Greenspan came up with this great idea. We'll get the baby boomers to pay for their own Social Security, and we'll just take the money out of that to make our huge deficits look smaller. Which is why when the little shrub was running around with his filing cabinets, he was able to say, oh, they're full of IOUs. Yeah, they were full of IOUs from back in the 80s when Reagan borrowed all that money. And they still don't want to pay it back. So what you got with Reagan, you got this whole generation of anti-tax, pro-corporate politicians and think tank heads. And they spend a lot of time, he spends a lot of time talking about Grover Norquist, who is basically calls himself a Reagan robot. Basically he's pushing that agenda. And what I found interesting in this guy's article, he says that only 13 members of Congress, only 13 Republican members of Congress have not signed his anti-tax pledge. That means 288 Republicans, 288 of them signed the formal pledge that they will not, under any circumstances, raise taxes. And what you've got now is you've got this thinking that government spending is killing the country. Government spending is choking job creation. Without understanding that the vast majority, the 99% of us at some point in our lives, are going to need something from the federal government in the form of a safety net, be it unemployment, be it food stamps, be it Social Security, whatever, LIHEAP, the TAA, whatever, you're going to need something at some point. But they've convinced the 99% of us that somehow we don't need this. And it's because of folks like Norquist, it's because of folks like Reagan who pushed this down our throats. And if you remember, not too long ago, you had Tom Coburn, the guy from Oklahoma, Crapo, the guy from Idaho, and Chambliss, the guy from Georgia, saying, you know what, we need to start maybe thinking about raising revenue. Well, what you got is you got Norquist who came down hard on them. And they do this. Anybody who has any idea that they're going to somehow increase revenue, they come after, and they come after big. And look at this guy, Dave Cogdill. He used to be the leader of the Republican Senate in California. He was talking about raising taxes to help balance their budget. In a midnight coup, they booted him out as the leader. Why? Grover Norquist. Because Norquist pulls the strings. What he did is he got all his minions out there. They got them all riled up, got them all lathered up, and out goes Dave. And Dave says now that, he's not sure if he would sign the pledge again. Really, you're not sure if you'd sign it again? He says, and this is what we've been saying all along, he says flat out, it makes it hard to respond to changing circumstances. He says that Republicans have lost the art of compromise. He also said, if we don't get everything we want, then we let the whole thing burn. That is the scorched earth policy that we've been talking about on this program. The Republicans have got their fingers in their ears. They're kicking their feet and screaming, I want what I want, and I don't care. I don't care what happens, and it's coming over this debt ceiling thing. You look at the fact that 10 Republican senators, have taken the pledge. They have put their hand up and said, I pledge not to increase any debt limit at all. The debt limit is not going to increase until Congress passes a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. Stop and think about that for a second, Jake. They're saying we're going to let nothing happen. until we hold this country hostage and two-thirds of the states ratify a constitutional amendment that makes us balance, have a balanced budget.
And you know you can't, long-term, you can't run a government like that. As you said on this show several times, you cannot run government like your budget at home. You cannot. You have to be more flexible for the very survival of this republic.
And guess who one of the 10 were?
Let me guess, our distinguished senator. Oh, that was a tough one. Mr. Toomey, who happens to be to the right of Santorum in some issues, that wasn't a tough guess.
Not a tough guess at all. In fact, his former group, Club for Growth, along with Citizens United, along with Freedom Works, and along with Let Freedom Ring, they support the proposal. They've also got 11 Republicans in the House who have signed on. Now, Matt, now think about this for a second. They're basically saying, we're going to hold the country hostage until we get this holy grail. We're going to hold you hostage. We're going to let the country go straight to hell. Bernanke's out there saying, look, we have got to raise this. And in fact, the Fed Reserve Chair Bernanke had a press conference today where he reiterated his view that if we chop short-term spending, if we do what Republicans want to do, which is basically whack this recovery off at the knees, it's going to lead to massive, massive job loss, and it's going to harm our economic recovery. He says, quote, I don't think that sharp, immediate cuts in the deficit would create more jobs. He goes on to say, I think in the short run, you know, the fiscal tightening is at best neutral and probably negative for job creation. Now, look, at the end of this, it's what we've been saying from the beginning. If you do this, if you go and you slash and burn, what will happen to the economic recovery? You see states across this country laying off thousands of state and government workers. And it's harming us. And in fact, the Brookings Institute today released a report saying just that. That laying off all of these government workers threatened to slow the already slow motion economic recovery. It goes on to say job growth, though occurring in most metropolitan areas in the past, was sluggish. Those that suffered the most, as well as those with the weakest economic recoveries, typically lost government jobs. So what they're talking about is, look, you know, the more jobs we're costing ourselves, the more taxpayers that we're taking off the rolls and putting onto the back of the state through unemployment and food stamps and LIHEAP and all of the other programs in their safety net, it's costing us more than it's helping us. And those jobs that they used to do, we're still paying someone to do just in the private sector at a higher wage. And that's the thing that gets me. No one's been able to show me where firing a bunch of state workers and then hiring private sector workers has benefited us. In fact, right now, from what I understand, in Memphis, they're talking about privatizing trash collection in Memphis. And I'm going, really? Have we forgotten our history that much? It's one of those things that just makes you go, do we really, really want to live in a conservative world? Where everything has a price, where everything's for sale, or every time I cross the street, I'm going to have to reach into my pocket, or every time I need something done in my community, I've got to reach in my pocket. Every time there's a sick child, I've got to walk past a bake sale or a car wash. Every time something happens, there's got to be a collection. Every time there's a crisis, we've got to ask for donations. Is that the kind of country we're going to become? Because it seems like it to me. I get tons of requests for donations. Every time I turn around, there's a sick child who needs this or that because the family doesn't have health care and they're doing car washes and bake sales. And I give, as we should. But should the family have to go through this? What kind of a country have we become? Right back after this.
Yeah.
Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Last weekend, the Workers' Independent News traveled to Netroots Nation. This year, the main focus was on organized labor, sparked mostly by the uprising in the state of Wisconsin. Nearly every panel we attended mentioned the Wisconsin moment and how it has sent waves of inspiration through the country and has changed the way progressive organizations and labor unions fight their battles. Van Jones was one of the keynote speakers of the event. He said one of the lessons he's learned from both the Tea Party and the spontaneous action in Wisconsin is that there is no more room for single, charismatic leaders. Instead, organizations need to unite and focus on charismatic networks.
That's the genius of the Tea Party. They have charismatic leaders of a certain kind. But if Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck and Dick Armey had a press conference tomorrow and said the Tea Party is over, it wouldn't be over because the values and the network wouldn't let it.
Peggy Mears is a member of the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, an organization that formed to help homeowners struggling with foreclosure to take on the banks. Mears spoke on a panel called The Empire Strikes Back, The Fate of Wall Street Reform. And she tapped into the inspiration she's felt in her state from what she witnessed happen in Wisconsin.
Wall Street bankers and Republicans with their deregulation mentality is the cause of the financial crisis. You will not put that on teachers. You will not put that on our public workers such as police and firefighters. We're not going to have it. We're standing with Wisconsin.
On Friday, four buses of online activists traveled to the Minneapolis Stone Arch Bridge, which stands in the view of the I-35 bridge that collapsed 4 years ago. There, the laborers were holding a rally to push for investment in the nation's eroding infrastructure. Terrell Clark of the Blue-Green Alliance said that infrastructure doesn't simply mean roads and bridges.
We want to make sure that we can continue to have safe and clean drinking water. We need to make those investments now, create those good jobs, and make sure that we're moving forward. Every day, 7 billion gallons of clean drinking water are lost to leaking pipes.
Laborers President Terrence O'Sullivan also spoke on the bridge, and he pushed the message spread 2 miles away in the convention center.
Let us fight together and let us win together, not only for infrastructure, but let's be radical in our approach. We need to be radical when it comes to the fight for workers' rights, for human rights, for civil rights, for infrastructure jobs, and the right to put people back to work again. And I know that we will do it. So let us stand together, let us fight together, and let us win together.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I work for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work, hate the rules, my bosses knew would leave. We had layoffs again this morning. I got my children now that I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me. When did I become a problem? How did folk become online? The governor says, tightening the belt, the only one that tightened is mine.
I gotta tell you, that no truer words ever spoken. You know, the governor tells me we're tightening our belts, but the only people who seem to be tightening the belt is me. And you look at New Jersey, their Republican Governor Christie, proposing $30 million in cuts to child care centers. What's that going to do for the low-wage worker who needs help going to work every day? What's that going to do to the economy? You look here in Pennsylvania, we got a governor saying, you know what? We're going to cut $1 billion from education. We're going to cut 56% of the higher education budget. I don't see them cutting any their belts. In fact, I see him buying 4 new vehicles for him and his wife and for Callie and his wife. I see them doing quite fine. And I see them handing out hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks to corporations. I see them doing just fine. I see Corbett threatening to veto any tax on the drillers. Doing just fine. Amazing stuff. Now, there's negotiations going on for the state workers' contracts. Again, we're going to see how badly the state workers are going to get screwed in this deal. That's why I've asked Ken Jasper. He's a member of SEIU Local 668 here in the area to come talk to us. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, hi. How's it going, Rick? Hey, thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. Can you? I know you can't get into the specifics of the negotiation, but can you tell me how things are going?
Well, I'll tell you what. We just actually, and as far as SEIU, we just broke down negotiations 20 minutes ago. We've been negotiating all day, and the one thing that we've learned that the Commonwealth is able to say very clearly is no. There's a lot of no's in this, okay? And it's they're being a bit draconian, actually. I'm sure they have an agenda, and I'm sure that a lot of it may be just, you know, maybe it's part of the whole dance of negotiations right now, but it doesn't look like they're willing to be as reasonable as we'd like them to be. How's that sound?
Well, I would not expect them to be reasonable at all. To be honest, I'm surprised that Corbett and his staff, I'm surprised they're not as bad as some of the governors we've seen. And maybe they will become that bad, and they're just going through this charade at this point because, you know, as you've pointed out, all they keep saying is no. Maybe they wait till the end of the road, say, well, we couldn't come to any agreement. We're going to impose our way of thought here. What are your thoughts of that?
Well, I believe legally they'll be thrown into arbitration, so who knows what will happen at that point, okay? And there's a lot of other state unions, and what they like to do is get one of the state unions to agree to something and then sort of use that as a template to lever the other ones in line.
Right.
And, you know, so it's a complicated process. There's lots of lines in the union contractors. There's we spent a lot of time, I think, on the small stuff. Big stuff, of course, is you know, wages and benefits, you know, but all the little work rules, things, and everything else, they were pretty willing to deal with. But once again, once you got to the actual numbers, and I think, and once again, you look at the current client that's been set up since Wisconsin, Ohio, New Jersey, and then just recently, understand, New York. Okay, it's really hard because what they really want to do is say, you know, public employees, okay, and public employee unions are evil, and there's a hidden agenda there, and we know that, okay? But part of the problem you have is when you look at the public employees and you look at union employees in general, we do extraordinary things, and we serve the Commonwealth well. I I'm not a member of AFSCME, but I really think that maybe what we should do is seriously stop negotiating for contracts in June and July and start negotiating for contracts in January and February when those snowplow drivers are out there.
Excellent, you know? Excellent point.
I mean, these guys are getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to make the roads safe for you, you know. Most of us, we're basically mostly working in social services and stuff. I myself work for the state employment service. It's been rough, okay, ever since they collapsed the economy in 2008. And who was president then? Oh, yeah, George Bush. I remember him. when Edward Bush collapsed the economy in 2008 because of his incredibly prescient economic idea of what was it? To give as much tax breaks as you can to the rich. And we saw how that trickled down into huge unemployment. So we've been working like crazy. The people in the unemployment insurance, they've been working like crazy. It's a really tough job. I know there's probably might be people listening out there who go, well, you know, they're making too much money and stuff. You know, I'd invite them, if they want to be a state employee, come on down, take a civil service test.
Yeah, here's the thing, Ken, and I'll be honest with you. I wouldn't want your job, and I wouldn't want to work for the state, because I got to be honest, I don't know how you wake up every morning and not walk out the door and just yell at every person you see, because the attacks that I see on you guys, and, you know, I was reading some economic numbers where, you know, that show me the average wage of a state employee, a public employee, is about $34,000 a year, which I don't think is much more than we pay the guy who manages the local Burger King.
Well, there you go. And if you're looking at a lot of our people who work in youth development centers, who work in prisons, who are counselors and stuff, you're dealing with a population that if they aren't dealing with us, endanger society, but the truth of the matter is our people are endangered. you know, and it's very, and once again, we're taking the hit. So it does take special people and to do this job. And it is tough, and we don't go yelling down the streets, and sometimes you just fall into the work, but it is frustrating when you hear them attack public employees. I mean, although occasionally the public employees do get a little bit of a glory. You know what I mean? When they do something spectacular, like, you know, run into the Twin Towers at 911 to get people out and evacuate them. Those are public employees and union employees who did that.
We loved them. Boy, we made them heroes, didn't we?
Well, no, until they wanted to compensate them.
That's right. Until they wanted health care for their lung problems, and until they wanted, exactly. You know, I've got a friend who was a retired school teacher, and she always says, you know, they loved us when we were poor. In fact, when little Johnny and Susie would bring an apple in, that was our lunch, and we depended on that lunch to get by. And she used to say, as soon as I wanted to buy my own apple or, heaven forbid, a pear, that's when they turned against us.
Well, yeah, and the deal is, it became also a situation. I'm going to tell you, I've been doing this for about 25 years now, and when I first went to work for the state, I was being paid nothing almost, seriously, compared to my peers, who at that time, I'm from Western Pennsylvania, the mills were still, or there were still mills you could get a job into, you know, in a manufacturing plant, and these guys laughed at me. You know, saying, well, why would you do that? And I said, well, I don't know. I it's something I'd rather do. You know, I mean, I can work in a mill. I've been a window cleaner. I've done all kinds of stuff. But what happens is that, now it's 25 years later, I've done my time and trust me, the little pay increments you get, it takes a long time to lay that up that you actually are making a wage where you don't have to actually worry too much about overspending when you go to a fast food restaurant. But the thing is, now they're looking at me and they're saying, you make too much.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Well, you know, where were you 25 years ago? Where were you when I was doing all this work over that, all that time? And I was getting paid significantly less than everybody else. And my question to them is, I'm not getting paid too much. You're getting paid too little.
Amen.
And that's what happened to these people.
Exactly. What happened that someone would look at you and say, you don't deserve because I don't have, instead of saying, well, how do I get what you've got? It's really, and I've likened it, and I've said this a number of times in the program, I've likened it to Stockholm Syndrome. The American worker has some form of this, PTSD, whatever you want to call it, that makes them think that way.
I'm here to tell you, Rick, you took the words right out of my mouth, because I've used that term lots of times, too. And it's almost, it's weird, too, because, and even I've seen, and we were talking union and stuff like that, and I think a lot of people probably have worked place where you have bosses who are unreasonable or you know, whatever. And I've actually had people go, well, you know, Ken, why don't you just drop that, either personally or for one of the workers, because we are a union. You know, why don't you just drop it now? Because management has backed off. You know what? That's like saying to a woman, you know, doggone it, they stopped raping you. What's your complaint now?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And so it becomes a Stockholm Syndrome where it's like, well, geez, they stopped pistol whipping me. They're pretty nice folks.
they're only kicking me now.
Yeah, they're only kicking me now. I'm kind of happy with this behavior, you know, because at least it's not as crazy as the previous behavior I put up with. It's a sad situation, and I often think, and my father was a World War II veteran, and he's passed, and I often think when I look at a lot of those guys from that generation, they were all union workers.
Yep.
You know, and they also were soldiers, and they really loved their country. They were patriots. And I'll tell you what, being a union member doesn't mean you're a communist. Okay? It means you're a patriot. It means you're on top of things. But a lot of these older guys are just aghast and amazed at how, I guess, docile this generation, and I'm more baby boomer. I'm a little older. I'm 56. But, you know, and people coming up are, well, geez, you know, we're just happy that.
Just happy to have a job.
Getting anything. You know, we're just happy.
Yep.
You know? It doesn't matter that you know, I'll never see the American dream. You know?
Sure they will, while they're sleeping.
Huh?
They'll see it while they're sleeping, the American dream.
Yeah.
While you're asleep.
There's an old Union song that was from the Wobblies, the Work and Pray, Live on Hay.
Yep.
You'll get pie in the sky when you die. and I think that's where we're at. So, I don't know. Like I said, Rick, it's odd. It's interesting to be here, doing the negotiations. But I do feel that public workers and public employees in general are just getting basically beat up in the media. I think there's a consistent plan and a reason why they're doing that.
You're the scapegoat.
Well, somebody has to be, I guess.
You're the red meat for the right to throw to the mindless minions.
Exactly. And the best thing you can do is if you can basically get your friends and neighbors to all start hating each other for some reason or another. It's easier to control. I mean, isn't that the oldest tactic in the world?
Sow
the seeds of discontent amongst the people who should be unified. And looking for who really took all the money, who really took all the jobs, and who's really, who's really controlling this whole situation at this time.
You mean you didn't steal all the money in 2008? It was those poor innocent bankers? Say it isn't so.
You know what? And I think that's part of the problem too. We don't see their excesses. I mean, we'll go into we'll be in the supermarket, and there's Mrs. Murphy down the street who happens to be on public assistance, and we'll see her buying something that we disapprove of. How dare she buy the name brand laundry detergent?
Yep.
She's on welfare. But what we don't see are those Wall Street types who took huge bailouts and had the gall to take our money from our pockets and give themselves $1 million bonuses.
It would be okay if it was just a million, though, Ken. It was hundreds of millions. It was billions.
Well, and we don't see them because, the average guy, the common guy, the working stiff, and the working men and women, okay, they just don't. And for some reason, we don't get into their clubs. We don't get to see them. So we don't get as outraged because they spend their money in places that most of us aren't allowed in.
Gated communities, there are special private clubs. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Ken. Last question before we wrap this up. I want to get back to the negotiations.
Sure.
Are there plans to go forward tomorrow? How's this going to look down the road? What's your sense?
Well, our union, that's the Service Employees International Union 668, the Pennsylvania Social Service Union. We wrapped it up for tonight. It's going to go forward tomorrow. I'd like to see, depending on the budget, and I know there's stuff coming up with Marcellus Shell and stuff in the Senate. Once again, the Commonwealth is speaking very much about, they just don't have the money. We have, and since we're the workers, we know where the cost savings can be. They sort of ignore us every time we bring up, here's places to save money, because I think they have a different agenda, and it's certainly not saving money. So it's going to be interesting to see how it all rolls out, but we start negotiating again tomorrow morning.
Well, I would love to hear back from you again real soon and follow this thing along because I think this is important, and I'd love to stay up on top of it.
Okay, and thank you so much for having me on, Rick.
All right, Ken, thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. Or working people come to talk.
They cut all our hours by Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a problem? How did the folk come online? The president says they're tightening their belt. The only one that's tightening is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Ah, love. A time of intimate talks, long phone calls, romantic dinners, and nonstop wooing. We can see these actions in the tender love story of Barack Obama. Not as a young man falling in love with Michelle, but as president, passionately pursuing his current heartthrob, Wall Street bankers. Obama is in hot pursuit of the elite financial royals he had once derided as fat cats.
This spring, however, charmed by the heft of their bankrolls, he invited 24 of the multimillionaires over to his house. The White House, that is. Gathered in the Blue Room, they spent more than an hour with the president, who turned them on by cooing aphrodisiacal words that bankers can't resist, such as tax cuts, deregulation, and I love you. After this snuggle session, Obama followed up with personal phone calls to Wall Streeters who had not been able to attend. Also, to demonstrate the depth of his affection for these money powers, the president is making a special trip to their private lair in New York City, taking a group of bankers, hedge fund operators, and private equity speculators to dinner at Daniel, the posh Upper West Side restaurant. Hey, nothing's too good for those you love. Excuse me, but it's embarrassing to see him kiss their sorry butts. These privileged princes of high finance crashed our economy, causing mass unemployment and hardships for millions of working-class families. Obama bailed them out, let them keep their pampered positions, and allowed them to return to their reckless casino culture. He's already done too much for them. This is Jim Hightower saying, Obama claims that he needs Wall Street's campaign cash to win re-election. But if he'd just stand up to these narcissists and stand up for America's workaday majority, he wouldn't need their money, because grassroots people would already be with him.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails. Personally, you know, great guest. A lot of good stuff out of Ken there. I particularly like the quote. They have a different agenda, and it's not saving money. And talking about the state with the negotiations. And you stop and you think about just that statement, and it really makes a lot of sense. They do have a different agenda, and it has nothing to do with saving money. It has a lot to do with privatizing. It has a lot to do with profitizing for their campaign donors. And you can move that to education as well. And we're seeing another bunch of Republicans pushing more of these voucher bills, since obviously SB1 is kind of being pushed. It's kind of been outed. I think people now get it. It's outed. It is the big privatizing handout machine that it was meant to be. I think folks woke up and said, you know what? This doesn't sound right to me. There are 144 schools that are failing, and we're going to privatize all of them? All 3,300? So there's this very small number of schools that are quote-unquote failing, and we're going to destroy the whole system just for those? Doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any sense. And really to highlight the point that SB1 really is all about profit, I got this press release from this group called the Grassroots Coalition for Real School Choice. And they say that they're, a group of, 20 Pennsylvania groups, probably with all staff hired from out of the state, like those Freedom Work nitwits who all live in Baltimore. But they got all these grassroots groups, and they announced today they were going to withhold their support for the school choice bill proposed by Jim Christiana, a Republican from the 15th district there. And they're going to continue to support the Kurt Schroeder bill. Going to continue that because, Christiana's bill limits the school choice, the voucher, the winning ticket, the lottery winning to only schools that are actually failing. And I got to be honest, I can almost see that. I can almost see the Christiana bill. But here's the reality. This is pure and simple about money. I mean, if this were really about the poor inner city kids, all those poor kids in dangerous and violent schools, they would support the Christiana bill, which I still think is dumb, but I get the argument. I do. I understand. There are 144 schools that are failing. I kind of understand. But why privatize, why invest money in a different direction when you could just fix the problem? I mean, 144 schools out of, 3,400? Not a big deal to me. We can fix those. We can, and we can move a little resource in that direction. We can do that. Because here's my problem. If you've got this building that's failing, if you build a brand spanking new building right next to it, what difference is this going to be? It's going to be in the same neighborhood. You're going to have the same social problems. You're going to have the same poverty problems. You're going to have the same kids. Oh, wait a minute. That's right. You're not going to have the same kids. You're going to be able to pick and choose which students you want. Oh, wait a minute. I thought this was the parents' choice. I thought this was the students' choice. That all the kids could go. So here's the thing. If I'm getting this right, and if I'm not, if I'm completely off base, and I know I'm not, all of those kids would move from the quote-unquote failing school over to the brand spanking new private for-profit charter voucher school, the opportunity school. What's the difference? Same kids. Just a different building. Oh, we get rid of those teachers, yes. Well, you can put computers in front of the room. The kids still aren't going to be any different. So explain to me what the difference is. And if it's so much different over in the brand spanking new corporate opportunity for profit school, why not do those things, which I think everybody would agree if it worked, we would be doing it already. Don't you think, Jake?
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. Shock of shocks. It isn't about education, it's about profit. I'm shocked.
And that's what bothers me. And again, it goes back to what the guy said. It's not about saving money. It's about everything else. It's about privatizing. It's about incentivizing campaign donations to move in that direction. And I firmly believe that. Now, we could make an argument. We could have a very spirited discussion that, you know what, giving parents a choice is a good thing. And I would love to send my kids to a Montessori school. Because I believe in that. We should be talking about different ways to educate children. I think the rigid first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade, I think that is wrong thinking in this world. Because we don't hold kids back anymore. We just keep pushing them forward, hoping to remediate down the line. You know, there's part of me that says we go and we have no grades. When you attain a certain level of basic competency, you move on to the next bit of information. So all kids are A students, and we don't have to worry about grades because eventually they're all going to get it. Seems reasonable to me. But as a society, are we going to pay for that? Because it may take a kid 15 years instead of 13. It may take them 15 and a half years to master that 13 years of education. But do we want to pay for that? You know, when I was a kid, and I'm sure when you were a kid, Jake, there were people who were every at the end of the year, they were sweating out that poor report card going, did I go on to the next grade or am I sticking here again?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It happened every year. You're absolutely right.
But, you know, I have yet to hear any of my daughter's friends or any parents talk about their kids failing. You don't see that anymore. When I was a kid, you had it pretty frequently. There was a percentage of the kids that kept falling behind. Why? Because they didn't get to the next. And this has everything to do with more corporatization, more MBAs taking over the school boards, more business people taking over the administrator's office. How do we get these kids through? How do we make sure that we save money? How do we make sure that we use the tax base effectively? Not about educating kids anymore. It's about budgets. It's all about budgets. So are we surprised when there's a percentage of the kids who go through and at the end, oh, gee, they can't read? No, not surprised at all.
Don't forget teaching for the test, too, which is another problem. But that's,
oh, don't get me started on the damn test.
That's No Child Left Behind.
We're gonna make 2+2 proprietary information and gonna have to pay some testing agent like the one Neil Bush owns to have the honor of putting the test in front of the child. What's 2+2, Johnny? Oh, sorry, I gotta pay for the test before you can take it. And you know, we went to that talkers conference, one of the people we met there. He said, you know, the big entrepreneurial push is now in education. Everything for education, software, all of this stuff, it's all going to be education-based. That's where the big money is going to be, because they're going to privatize education. This is a move across the country. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this with Eric Loomis. He's one of the bloggers over at Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Are when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make things happen!
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing light is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
An innocent bystander. Somehow I got stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I'm down on my luck.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, one of my favorite quotes in response to the question, what does labor want? AFL founder and President Samuel Gompers said, what does labor want? We want more schoolhouses and less jails, more books and less arsenals, more learning and less vice, more leisure and less greed, more justice and less revenge. In fact, more of the opportunities to cultivate our better natures. And that's the kind of more I think all working people want. And it's that push towards that kind of more that I think built the middle class and built the class that kept looking towards the stars and saying, yes, we can, instead of saying, well, maybe not. And I look at this this outrage over what is modest change, basically just streamlining a system that it hasn't changed much, just streamlining a system to make sure workers get their rights. And the right has lost their ever-loving freaking mind. In fact, the left has too in some cases. And I have to say, I'm not shocked by how little support is being shown in the corporate-dominated mainstream media because, for the most part, they're controlled by union busters too. Anyway, that's why I've asked Eric Loomis. He's a blogger over at lawyersgunsmoneyblog.com. Eric, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this NLRB push to kind of just streamline these rules a little bit, make it a little more efficient, make it a little more streamlined. The right's losing their mind over it, and some on the left.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it goes to show just how, you know, in case people didn't already know, just how vociferous the attack on unions are today. I mean, even people in the Democratic Party, the party of Franklin Roosevelt, are have no problem with destroying unions. I mean, it's a sad day.
Yeah, I've been saying that a couple of things that pops out at me. One, how little people know about how little they know about the NLRB. Spent a little time today asking people what if they knew what NLRB stood for and what it meant, and I found that nobody did. And the other part of this is the outrage is because for 30 years the NLRB has been used against workers, and now finally they're stepping up and saying, employers, you've gone a bit too far.
Yeah, no, and I mean, you know, it's amazing that an organization or an agency that was developed to give working class people a fair shake, you know, when it begins to do that again, the right absolutely goes ballistic. But again, so do a lot of the left, and that's it's just a sad day.
Yeah, there was a statement by one of the right-wing blogs, oh, we need to do away with the NLRB,
right.
Do away with the Wagner Act, do away with the Rail Act, and I say, okay, let's do away with that. Because what's happened is they've used those laws to restrain us. I'm all in favor of going back to the days of sit-down strikes. I'm in the favor of the days of going back into the streets.
Well, you know, I think that we're reaching a day where that has to happen. I mean, I think that, you know, as somebody who's studied labor unions for a long time, who's a member of a union, you know, who writes about unions, the fact is that, you know, we are a long time from a day when radicalism was something that the unions did, when people did go into the streets and all of this. And I think because of that, you know, because we've sort of lost that history, people aren't sure how to respond to these attacks. And, you know, the working class is just getting killed here. And, you know, in some ways it's kind of sad that we have to go back to radicalism, because it means that people are losing all the gains that they made over the last 70 years, but that's where we're at.
Yep, and here's in bringing that up, you know, this week I've been talking about this concept of the benevolent corporation, because someone on my Facebook page said, well, unions are just trying to con workers into thinking that their employers don't care about them, and the reality is their employers don't care about them.
Yeah.
Look what happened in September 2008 when they kicked hundreds of thousands of you workers into the street and did for months.
Right. And I mean, ever since the development of the modern corporation, they haven't cared about workers. I mean, they've always tried to find cheaper labor, bust the unions, move to a country where they don't have environmental restrictions, you know, where they can dump all their waste in the water and then, you know, then the children of their workers die from it. I mean, this is the reality. And that's why, you know, and the government, the federal government, over the last 30 years has not only facilitated it, but encouraged it.
Yeah, well, because here's the really sad part in all of this. No matter how you look at it, corporations are funding both sides of the game.
Sure.
You know, one of the statistics I saw, the Republicans got 79% of their campaign contributions from the Fortune 500, but Democrats got 72%.
Sure. And these corporations more or less want Republicans to win, and we see what the Chamber of Commerce is doing and funding, you know, the Tea Party and all these other, you know, and some of these other groups. But Democrats are equally desperate to get that money. And now we see Obama, you know, ready to do whatever he takes to make good with Wall Street so he gets campaign contributions for 2012. And, I mean, you know, what is that going to mean? I mean, I think that's probably going to mean that if Wall Street needs something over the rights of labor, that they're going to get it.
Yep. You know, I go back, and again, we have to, and the sad reality is, as you said earlier, we may have to relive the history again, go back and fight the same fights and do the same things. And I think this time it'll be much more difficult. But again, I like Samuel Gompers, and I like some of the quotes that he have been attributed to him, like this one: the man who has his millions will want everything he can lay his hands on and then raise his voice against the poor devil who wants 10 cents more a day.
Sure.
And absolutely, that's where we are today.
Mm-hmm. I think that the ultimate challenge is that when unions succeeded in the 1930s, you know, they were building on 50, 75 years of radicalism where, you know, people knew what it meant to go in the streets. They knew the kind of sacrifices it would take. They understood the history of their ancestors in this incredible struggle. And a lot of working people still understand that, but a whole lot of Americans don't. And, you know, and people have so bought into free market capitalism that it's hard to convince people after being promised for decade upon decade that this was going to pay off for the working class, and then it doesn't, well, that history seems lost. And that to me is the challenge, is rebuilding that radical movement.
Well, do you think, and I look back to the boom-bust cycles of the 1800s, the 1880s, 1890s, you know, going up to the, leading up to the Great Depression, and we're reliving all that now. I mean, this is, we're heading down that road to the big collapse that I think may be coming, sadly, for my children.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Karl Rove said once in an article that he thought America didn't go wrong in the 1930s. Is that it went wrong under Theodore Roosevelt and the progressives in the 1900s, when they even began to do things like workers' compensation laws and the beginnings of an eight-hour day and these sorts of things. It's the open goal of these people to take our nation back to those boom-bust cycles of the 1880s and 1890s, where you have this small elite of incredibly wealthy people and millions who don't have enough to eat. And I think they're fairly open about this.
No, I think they're extremely open. In fact, you know, one of the things, and what surprised me, because we had gone out to Wisconsin during the height of the, you know, of the uprising there. What I think surprised people in Wisconsin is when Walker said he was going to call out the National Guard, the people of Wisconsin on a visceral level understood what that meant, because they had had just a little bit of labor education in the schools, and they learned about governors calling out the militia and calling out the National Guard to shoot strikers and to bust strikes up, and they took to the streets.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I think that, you know, that's one of the great things about Wisconsin. I mean, obviously it has huge problems, but there is a state where people know what labor means. They still know what that means. And, you know, there's other states that do as well. Ohio, where I've been living the last year, Pennsylvania. But, you know, there's a lot of places in this country that just, unfortunately, even working class people are suspicious of organized labor. And even though they're getting fleeced as well. And so it's, you know, it's a challenge. And I think the thing I hope that comes out of Wisconsin is that it opens people's eyes around the nation to just what the, you know, what is the Republican agenda. And maybe people will finally become aware of that. I mean, I think that's what we have to hope for here.
Well, let me ask you this, you know, because there's some on the left, and, you know, I've talked to people who say, well, you know, times are good. You know, times are okay. I've still got, you know, my car. I've still got, you know,
right,
a big screen TV. I can still feed the kids. We don't need to cause trouble just yet. Everything's okay.
Right, right. Well, I mean, you know, I would say that, you know, a strong labor movement is what created the benefits that working class people have in modern America. Right. It was getting people, you know, eventually getting them good wages. But at first, you know, getting their kids out of the factories and into schools, getting an 8-hour day, getting better wages. And then what working people have today with their TVs and their phones. And that's great. But that is in no small part the work of their ancestors fighting for a fair share of the pie. And today you have corporations trying to take that share of the pie away. And people are trying to hold on to their phones and their TVs and their, you know, and their nice houses, and they're doing so through credit, right, through unsustainable debt, because they're trying to hold on to the American dream. And we need a strong labor movement to protect what working people have gotten over the last 100 years, because if we don't, then everyone who believed that capitalism in its current form was going to work for them is going to find all of this stuff taken away and suddenly thrust back into a world that we haven't seen since the 1930s. And I think that's just an incredible tragedy.
It is an incredible tragedy. But, you know, the problem with having that big screen TV and having the cell phones and having all this instant access internet, and we're being inundated by messages from the moneyed elite, if you will.
Sure.
You know,
I go back
to the Jay Gould quote. I could easily pay half the country to kill the other half.
Yeah.
If you just give them enough propaganda. And all we're seeing now is, well, we're going to have high unemployment for years. So government's not going to push full employment policies, and
yeah,
we need to push free trade agreements, because you know what, globalization is part of the, you know, it's just what it is, and we
right.
need small, ineffective, useless government who can't enforce rules like the National Labor Relations Board. Oh, and we need labor who's flexible so that corporations want to invest here. Again, what it is it's really putting a worker in a box and squeezing the life right out of them.
That's right. And you know, I mean, the level of sophistication of the media messages is so strong that, you know, essentially you don't have other messages being told, right? That on television among even most Democratic politicians now, you simply don't have an alternative to, you know, a sort of extremist capitalism of, you know, rapid globalization and a race to the bottom. There's no alternative message being given. And so, you know, and it serves, I think, to make workers, A, believe capitalism is working for them, and B, gives them no alternative for any or no possibility for any kind of alternative in the future.
Well, anything else is either communism or socialism or Marxism. It's all of that stuff.
That's right.
And you know what? Because you hit on an important part there, that the whole messaging. And I think Frank Luntz is an absolute genius. That whole death tax thing, just masterful linguistics. I think it's horrible policy to make sure that the very wealthy never pay the estate tax. But from a messaging standpoint, what? I'm going to have to pay taxes when I die?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that the Democratic Party, and to a small extent, a lot of, you know, mainstream leaders of the labor movement over the last 20 or 30 years seem to believe that, you know, if we just sit down and we talk about things and everybody plays by the rules, you know, we can have a civil society. And over and over and over again, it feels like they just get destroyed by these sophisticated messages, just like you talk about the death tax, where we're talking about, you know, taxes as, you know, as a negative thing, as a tax burden rather than a, you know, a patriotic contribution to your nation or something like this, right? That in every issue, Democrats and labor find themselves behind the eight ball on the messaging. And the messaging is so important, and somehow we have to do a better job of that.
Well, you are so right on that. You know, because here's the thing. You're right. Democrats want to sit and negotiate, and you do have some labor people who you know, yeah, we just want to protect what we've got. You know, we'll sit and negotiate. Well, Republicans, they just want to smack you in the mouth and take your lunch money.
That's exactly right. And I think what labor needs to do again is be happy to smack them right back in the mouth.
Yep, and that's why they've lost the white middle class, your white blue collar worker. Because you know, even if you're wrong, and that's the reason I think people loved Bush at first. Even if he was wrong, if he was going down the wrong road, he knew he was going somewhere, and he was decisive in it, and no one was going to change his mind.
Right. That's right. I think a lot of what people want is leadership. I mean, with Obama, people saw in him during his campaign a leader who promised change, and people were very attracted to that. And then Obama, the president, didn't provide a whole. I mean, you know, he did some good things, and you know, getting health care passed is great, and bailing out the automobile industry. I mean, that saved a tremendous number of union jobs, and that's great. But he seemed more interested in negotiating than providing real leadership that people could follow, and that mass movement that he built that looked like maybe this was going to build into a new grassroots progressive movement just sort of slipped away.
That just fizzled out. Last question, getting back to the NLRB thing. You know, as we move down the road here, I question why they put it out when they did, considering, you know, the Boeing situation.
Yeah.
How much pushback do you think this is going to be? We're going to see a bill to defund the NLRB, maybe?
Well, you know, I wouldn't be a bit surprised to see a bill. I mean, it's not a bill I think that has any chance of passing at this point. But, I mean, I think it is extremely concerning because what we've seen is the most crazy Republican ideas that we all laugh off, oh, there's no way that would ever happen. 5 years later, that's mainstream Republican policy.
Yep.
And so I would not be a bit surprised to see a bill put out there and it becomes, you know, over the next few years, central to Republican ideology. And the next time there's a Republican president and a Republican-controlled Congress, that boom, it gets passed, and the NLRB is dead. And, you know, that's would just be one more piece of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, you know, the greatest program ever for the American working class, dismantled, and it's sad.
Yeah, like I tell people, Republicans were against it from the beginning, and
yes,
they've been against it ever since.
That's exactly right. So were corporations.
Yep. Eric Loomis, blogger over at lawyersgunsmoneyblog.com. Great talking to you. I'd love to have you back again soon.
Anytime. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one? Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well. Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211. How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave? Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike. Call him at 243-3211. You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too. So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings. That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's bash crazy. Rick Smith.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. There was part of me who knew she couldn't do it. But the report came out on a Real Politics today that Sarah Palin had quit her high-profile bus tour halfway through and was going to go take the family back to Alaska. Then the reports came out, well, she's not quitting her tour. She's doing something else. Then the reports came out, oh, well, you know, she's doing this. And then the reports came out, blah, blah, back and forth. And I'm sitting here going, this woman is an absolute media genius. She's got the entire media going, she quit. No, she didn't. She quit. No, she didn't. Personally, she's a quitter. I mean, I guarantee she probably quit this and then, fell into it. Oh, they reported on it. Finally, someone's paying attention to me. Because have you heard any reports of her going anywhere else? No. I haven't heard anything about her. What I did hear is she canceled a trip to Sudan. Another thing she has decided she was going to quit. You got to give her credit. And here's the thing. I go back to my mother. When I was 8 years old, I still remember the day. I was not very good at baseball as an 8 year old. In fact, I was playing on a team with 10 and 11 years old. So I was the small kid and I was the one who got beat up all day long. So I wanted to quit. And my mother said, no, you're going to finish the year whether you like it or not. You're going to go to every game. You're going to go to every practice. That's it. Bottom line. Because if you quit now, you'll be a quitter for the rest of your life. I'm kind of thinking that she may have a good lawsuit against her parents for letting her quit something when she was like 7. There's part of me that thinks that. Because every time you turn around, she's quitting something else.
Like what, 3 different colleges, if you remember?
Yeah, she couldn't find her niche.
She couldn't find her niche. In Hawaii.
Looking for a niche. reports, former U.S. Senator and GOP presidential hopeful, homeboy, Tricky Ricky Santorum, he blasted Obama and the administration Monday in the Des Moines Register. He took this shot at Eric Holder, saying that advocating for the use of civilian courts to try terror suspects, maybe he's eating mushrooms. I don't know what he's doing. You can't even make this stuff up. How does Tricky Ricky know about mushrooms? And how does he know what do they do? I thought he was Mr. Straight Lace, Mr. Straight Shooter. Thought he, crazy guy. Our friend Lee Fong caught Tricky Ricky there in Iowa, and he asked him, he said, why is it that when Clinton got caught doing his little thing, you called for him to resign. But Diaper Dave Vitter, you didn't bother to ask. You know, you didn't. And he had a very interesting, thought on this. And maybe I got to give Tricky Ricky some credit for thought. He said that he called for, and you know, the whole, all of that, that sin stuff, which for a religious fanatic, I just can't believe he put aside. But he was saying that, well, Clinton lied. He lied in court. So that's why I called for his resignation. And Diaper Dave Vitter, he didn't lie. You know, other than to his wife and everybody else. But he didn't lie in court. Well, they never brought him into court, whole other thing. But kind of nice how they, you know, how neat, easy things work for them.
He didn't lie. Well, I believe he was caught and exposed.
Well, no, his name was in the DC Madams book, and then the story started coming out about his preference of, you know, of wearing diapers and soiling himself and being cleaned, and you know, there was a CSI episode about that. It was kind of weird then, but yeah, you know, God bless him. Turns out Newt Gingrich back in the news again. I remember he, half his campaign just basically left, and then the other, his finance team quit, because he's in hock $1 million. They probably saw that their checks were going to bounce and said, well, we're out of here. Turns out, his campaign acknowledged yesterday that, Gingrich had a second line of credit at the jewelry store Tiffany's, $1 million. And I'm going, that's $1.5 million in credit line from Tiffany's. How much jewelry do you need, Calista? And then I'm thinking, you know, maybe, you know, I'm just thinking. I'm not making accusations. I'm just thinking. You know, sometimes when guys get themselves into trouble, they do something stupid, you know, like love their country too much and fall into an affair, you know, just tripping on the sidewalk, you know, and right in, sorry. That maybe, you know, they make up by bringing jewelry. And I'm looking at $1.5 million, somewhere $1.5 million. How much screwing up is
that? That's some big sins there.
Yeah, I mean, that's some big sins. Well, I'm not saying he did anything wrong.
Well,
I'm saying that, you know, there's some guys who do that.
On the Internet, it was all over the Internet, and there's also some accusations that maybe some of the educational background that he takes credit for isn't totally accurate either. And there's some supposition that somebody's throwing out the question, well, we wonder if she's going to be leaving him this time.
Well, we'll see. We shall see. He's also in a little bit of trouble. He said that he wants to repeal legislation to audit the Fed. He says he wants to go in and get rid of Dodd-Frank, all that legislation. But he also wants to, we need to go after the Fed. We need to audit the Fed. But we need to get rid of Dodd-Frank. Here's the thing. Dodd-Frank already has a mandate to audit the Fed. So on one hand, he's going to repeal the audit of the Fed, but he's going to say he's going to do it. Kind of funny. John Huntsman in the news said that that redefining marriage is something that's impossible, you know, because it's something impossible, but it's something he's not in favor of. He's a guy who did sign the expansion of domestic partnership, kind of a death blow in Republican realms. He said, you know, it's okay that, you know, gay couples have, you know, those civil rights where they can, you know, see each other in the hospital and have some, you know, have some rights as a couple. He did sign that in Utah. You figure that out. So I'm thinking that's going to be a death blow. Also, he has reportedly warned his fellow Republicans to stay hawkish and stay in Afghanistan. Don't let that Obama pull those troops out of there. Keep going. So that's where they're making their bones. And lastly, Governor Christie has hit all-time low polling ratings. 47% of New Jerseyans do not approve of the job being done by Christie, which is, you know, down from 44% from his approval, 44%. Here's the thing, 67% saying he's not going to make a good vice president, please. And I would be saying go. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Come from the cities and they come from the small towns. Beat up cars, tires and drummers go. Crash, boom, bam. R.C.K. in the USA. R.C.K. in the USA. R.C.K. in the USA. Yeah, yeah.
deeply blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Last weekend, the Workers' Independent News traveled to Netroots Nation. This year, the main focus was on organized labor, sparked mostly by the uprising in the state of Wisconsin. Nearly every panel we attended mentioned the Wisconsin moment and how it has sent waves of inspiration through the country and has changed the way progressive organizations and labor unions fight their battles. Van Jones was one of the keynote speakers of the event. He said one of the lessons he's learned from both the Tea Party and the spontaneous action in Wisconsin is that there is no more room for single, charismatic leaders. Instead, organizations need to unite and focus on charismatic networks.
That's the genius of the Tea Party. They have charismatic leaders of a certain kind. But if Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck and Dick Armey had a press conference tomorrow and said the Tea Party is over, it wouldn't be over because the values and the network wouldn't let it.
Peggy Mears is a member of the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, an organization that formed to help homeowners struggling with foreclosure to take on the banks. Mears spoke on a panel called The Empire Strikes Back, The Fate of Wall Street Reform, and she tapped into the inspiration she's felt in her state from what she witnessed happen in Wisconsin.
Wall Street bankers and Republicans with their deregulation mentality is the cause of the financial crisis. You will not put that on teachers. You will not put that on our public workers such as police and firefighters. We're not going to have it. We're standing with Wisconsin.
On Friday, four buses of online activists traveled to the Minneapolis Stone Arch Bridge, which stands in the view of the I-35 bridge that collapsed 4 years ago. There, the laborers were holding a rally to push for investment in the nation's eroding infrastructure. Terrell Clark of the Blue-Green Alliance said that infrastructure doesn't simply mean roads and bridges.
We want to make sure that we can continue to have safe and clean drinking water. We need to make those investments now, create those good jobs, and make sure that we're moving forward. Every day, 7 billion gallons of clean drinking water are lost to leaking pipes.
Laborers President Terrence O'Sullivan also spoke on the bridge, and he pushed the message spread 2 miles away in the convention center.
Let us fight together and let us win together, not only for infrastructure, but let's be radical in our approach. We need to be radical when it comes to the fight for workers' rights, for human rights, for civil rights, for infrastructure jobs, and the right to put people back to work again. And I know that we will do it. So let us stand together, let us fight together, and let us win together.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Let's have a tea party like the Romans do. We'll serve the finest tea and fancy cookies too. Let's go through the neighborhood inviting everyone. Let's have a tea party, won't it be fun?
Well, we'll see what kind of insanity comes out of the Tea Twizzler candidate people here in Pennsylvania with this budget. Also on the federal level, what they're doing there in D.C., I got to tell you, this budget stuff, just amazing. You've got 10 Republicans, scorched earth Republicans, who have said that they will not support raising the debt limit until there is a balanced budget amendment passed. I mean, that's really, really going out there. Amazing. In what has become a classic childhood game of, no, he did it. Transocean is accusing BP of neglecting risks in the oil spill. Today, the offshore drilling group Transocean charged BP for neglecting drilling risks, which led to the giant 2010 oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Transocean's internal report concludes that the Macondo incident was the result of a succession of interrelated well design, construction, and temporary abandonment decisions that comprised the integrity of the well and compounded the likelihood of its failure. So what you've got Transocean, who owned the rig, leased by BP, saying, no, them, they did it. They go on to say the decision many made by the operator BP in the 2 weeks leading up to the incident were driven by BP's knowledge that the geological window for safe drilling was becoming increasingly narrow. Now remember, deep water horizon when the rig blew back, I think, April 20th, 2010, killed 11 workers and spilled millions of gallons into the Gulf. Now, the group has said, the investigation found evidence that BP failed to properly assess, manage, and communicate any risks to its contractors. So, they're pointing the finger. But remember, and this is what I love about the end of the story, the U.S. made BP pay for the cleanup and $20 billion, for future problems. Remember Joe Barton came out and said, wait, it's a shakedown. I'm sorry. I feel sorry for you being shaken down, guys, like that. I didn't want you to be shaken down. I apologize. Turns out, you gotta love how this works. BP is now suing Transocean for $40 billion. So, in the end of this, BP, who most people are saying responsible, we're saying responsible, they're saying responsible, they're probably responsible. They could end up making money off of this disaster. You gotta love that. Come on, you gotta love it.
That's pretty hard to take because there was eyewitness testimony of the survivors. That said, in critical times, the manager of that project, who BP hired, they were overruled by corporate headquarters. Now BP's turning around and trying to turn the finger at.
Gotta love it.
In the end, it was BP's decision, according to the survivors.
Gotta love these corporations. You know who I'm loving right now, and if anyone has one of these, I gotta get one. Up in Northeast Pennsylvania, up in the Marcellus Shale area, there's a company, Talesman Energy. They are handing out coloring books, and I've absolutely got to get one of these coloring books. It is they're a company headquartered in Calgary, but it's I love this. It's great. Talisman Terry, the friendly Fracosaurus dinosaur. The natural gas, the drilling industry has put out a coloring book for children. And you look at all the happy, smiling people in Terry's world, the Fracosaurus, mom smiling, dad smiling, all the workers are happy and smiling, the dogs, the cats, the deer, the fish, the sun, the moon, the flowers, the rocks are even happy. Even the helium balloon, which they use to demonstrate how natural gas is lighter than air. Everyone's happy. Everyone's smiling. And basically, as the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette points out, the whole point of this thing is to, propagandize to the kids to say how smart drilling is and how safe it is. And even more, it's American. And again, I look at this and I'm going, really? We're going to have drilling coloring books for kids? The article talks to this woman, Natalie Cox, who's the head of the firm's U.S. communications, this Talisman Energy's communications. She says, let's keep our audience in mind. If you're talking to age 9 and younger, you can't get into questions like, what is fracking fluid? We're making a presentation here. If we were making that presentation to the governor, there in Harrisburg, we'd get technical, new details and stuff. We wouldn't be giving him a coloring book. I think a coloring book would probably help him, but you never know. Maybe there's something for George Bush's library, a fracking coloring book. But if anybody has one of these fracking coloring books, I would love to have it because it's beautiful. But again, it just goes to show the coal industry, the American Coal Foundation, they spent some $300,000 kind of pushing friendly, happy coal. They came out with a little jingle, to brainwash the children. And I'm going, who would give their kids, who in their right mind would give their kids a coloring book with a character named Talisman Terry, the friendly Fracosaurus? Really? A Fracosaurus? Find that in my in your history book. Find that in a book somewhere other than some propaganda from a from the drilling industry. It's not there. Fracosaurus jig.
You sure it wasn't on the, you know, Noah's Ark?
It was on Noah's Ark.
There you go.
A Fracosaurus. the thing is, you just can't make that kind of stuff up. Just can't do it. Here's some good news. The LA Times reported a bill allowing pesticide manufacturers and users to avoid the Clean Water Act. Has let that the permitting process move through the Senate Agricultural Committee today. If passed, Senate Bill H.R. 872 will let farmers spray pesticides near public waters without having to meet the Clean Water Act permitting requirements. You know, we talked last night to the guy about pesticides, and, you know, it's amazing to me that we just seem to not think about our drinking water for some reason. Yeah, go ahead, put those poisons in there. God, it doesn't kill us. We're super beings. We're super folk. We can drink pesticides. You know, and I always wonder, the CEO of companies like Monsanto and the CEOs of the people who make all these chemicals, do you think that they, you think they drink a glass of their product? I don't think so. And it scares me when you give these kind of, go ahead, spray as much as you want. That's only water. It'll go away. Don't worry about it. USA Today reported the sea level is now raising faster than anywhere at any time in the past 2,100 years. So here's the thing. Buy some beachfront property in Pennsylvania. We could at some point, maybe not in our lifetime, but down the road, maybe we lose all that shore and we got nice beachfront property right here in Pennsylvania. Because as you're seeing the global temperatures rise, and we've had really kind of a weird summer this year with high humidity and heat, the sea level's going up, and up. A study at the University of Pennsylvania, which was published this week in the Proceedings of Natural Academy of Science, showed that, we're getting screwed. And North Carolina for the past 80 years has seen this go up. So, good stuff. I can't wait to buy some of that beachfront property. Maybe in Jersey. Maybe we can get it in our lifetime somewhere in Jersey. Emergency response is rising to climate disaster. It is a growth opportunity for military defense contractors. The people now are kind of pulling out of Afghanistan, kind of pulling back from Iraq. So you had all these military contractors, who were setting up mobile hospitals and setting up, water filtration stuff, all this stuff in Iraq and Afghanistan, all that money we were spending into it. Maybe this is going to be a good thing for disaster capitalism. Because as our communities are being blown away and flooded and all of that, we now have the ability, thanks to the war, and you got to thank war, we got some good stuff out of war. We got mobile hospitals that, could have gone to Joplin, Missouri, but didn't. We could have water filtration systems that, could have gone, but didn't. Could have had all of this stuff. So the next person who directs FEMA may have the opportunity to do some of this. So disaster capitalism, that's the way to go. That is going to be the job creator of the next generation. The worse the weather gets, the better it's going to be for employment. Your house blows over, we'll build another one. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. A report on hiring in the Marcellus Shale fields disputed. Our friends over at the Keystone Research Center said, look, less than 10,000 jobs were created. Less than 10,000. And you got the people from the Marcellus Shale Coalition who are saying, no, we've had 72,000 new hires. And I think, the guy that we know over there, Steve Herzenberg, he said, look, you can't just keep track of the balance of your checkbook by looking at the deposits. You have to look at the amounts that are withdrawn. You got to look at the withdrawals as well. It's a balancing thing. So what they were doing, I guess they were just counting all the people who were being hired and not counting any of the people who had quit. But, it makes for good messaging. We hired 72,000 people. Granted, we only got one left, but we hired them, all 72,000. Just nuts. And, you know, you look at what's going on, the fact that we're still not anywhere near a rational tax, an extraction tax on this is just, I'm sure, I want to get that coloring book. Because I wonder if there's a page in there about an extraction tax. I wonder if there's like a, you know, a drill in the, you know, like a needle in the ground and it's chunk, chunk, you know, it's pumping and there are dollar signs flying out of it for kids to color. I wonder if that's there. But anyway, if anybody gets one of those, you got to let me know. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I have to have one of these coloring books. I'll put it online and I'll let people see it. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Ah, love. A time of intimate talks, long phone calls, romantic dinners, and nonstop wooing. We can see these actions in the tender love story of Barack Obama. Not as a young man falling in love with Michelle, but as president, passionately pursuing his current heartthrob, Wall Street bankers. Obama is in hot pursuit of the elite financial royals he had once derided as fat cats. This spring, however, charmed by the heft of their bankrolls, he invited 24 of the multimillionaires over to his house. The White House, that is. Gathered in the Blue Room, they spent more than an hour with the president, who turned them on by cooing aphrodisiacal words that bankers can't resist, such as tax cuts, deregulation, and I love you. After this snuggle session, Obama followed up with personal phone calls to Wall Streeters who had not been able to attend. Also, to demonstrate the depth of his affection for these money powers, the president is making a special trip to their private lair in New York City, taking a group of bankers, hedge fund operators, and private equity speculators to dinner at Danielle, the posh Upper West Side restaurant. Hey, nothing's too good for those you love. Excuse me, but it's embarrassing to see him kiss their sorry butts. These privileged princes of high finance crashed our economy, causing mass unemployment and hardships for millions of working-class families. Obama bailed them out, let them keep their pampered positions, and allowed them to return to their reckless casino culture. He's already done too much for them. This is Jim Hightower saying, Obama claims that he needs Wall Street's campaign cash to win re-election. But if he'd just stand up to these narcissists and stand up for America's workaday majority, he wouldn't need their money, because grassroots people would already be with him.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. The Borowitz Report, announcing a drawdown of American troops. President Barack Obama tonight maintained that the United States was not deserting Afghanistan, promising the Afghan people, we will continue to follow you on Twitter. Mr. Obama indicated that the United States' relationship with Afghanistan would soon transition from a military one to a social networking one, with the United States promising to like Afghanistan's Facebook page and share contact information on LinkedIn. In summing up the United States' 10-year military mission in Afghanistan, Mr. Obama said, quote, we have done everything we set out to do in Afghanistan, even though we actually did it in Pakistan. Mr. Obama detailed the United States' exit strategy, saying that troops would soon be leaving Afghanistan by way of Libya. He said that with troops coming or going to and or from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, by 2012, the United States will be fighting only two wars, 2.5 tops. The president's speech about Afghanistan ended on a stirring note. In conclusion, he said, my fellow Americans, I killed Osama bin Laden. There you go. So the end of the thing. You know, I watched the president's speech. Kind of made me go, not getting it. He said this kind of made me stop.
That is the responsibility of the Afghan government, which must step up its ability to protect its people and move from an economy shaped by war to one that can sustain a lasting peace.
An economy shaped by war to one that can be sustained by peace, lasting peace. Maybe that's advice we should be taking. Seems our economy is built on war. Some could argue we're in four of them. That seems to be where our manufacturing's aimed. Why don't we work on manufacturing other things for a change? And here's what this other statement really, really concerns me.
We must chart a more centered course. Like generations before, we must embrace America's singular role in the course of human events. But we must be as pragmatic as we are passionate, as strategic as we are resolute.
A centered course. Pragmatic. You know what that tells me? That tells me his mindset is centered, pragmatic, which means kiss Social Security by so long, Medicaid. We're going to have block grants for that. And Granny, don't get comfortable because we're going to give in to the Republicans on Medicare cuts. That's what it sounds like to me. I'm curious your thoughts.
I'm hoping you're wrong. It could be. I hope that's just political posturing. If the Democrats want to be the majority party, they will and they must fight every attempt to reduce benefits, Social Security and Medicare. That is the holy grail for millions and millions and millions of Americans. I guarantee you that if the Democrats want to be a minority party, agree to those cuts. See how you make out the next election.
Yeah, well, we'll see. You know, here's the good thing. There are some very happy, smiling people coming on right now. It's going to be the people who own TV stations. This next election cycle, they're saying, is all but certain going to set records for campaign advertising, for political advertising. Moody's Investors Service predicts in a new report that revenue from political ads for the presidential campaign and statewide races for governor and Congress will grow by 9 to 18%. Over the 2010 levels. That means they're going to spend about $3 billion on television ads. And, you know, like we talk about all the time, at the end of the day, issue ads, all of this media ends up in the hands of a very few people. Comcast is going to be smiling from ear to ear. They're going to be just jumping for joy. Sure, go ahead. We'll have both sides. You know, I listen to the right-wing conservative media outlets, and you hear different groups, different progressive groups, different labor unions putting ads on those stations, paying their money, paying $200 an ad to put their 30-second ad on that station, only to have it ripped to shreds for the next 3 hours. And I say, you know, that's really great logic. I'm really getting that, that you're basically funding the opposition. That's beautiful. But it is our media structure, and it's the consolidated nature of our media structure that really has me concerned. When you look at, you know, Comcast, big player now. Internet, phone, NBC, Universal, man, they're going to have it all. Six corporations. Last time I read, six corporations own 80% of everything we see, hear, and read. If that doesn't scare you, I don't know what does. The consolidated nature of our media is really bad for our democracy. You know, that whole Comcast NBC Universal merger should have never happened. And it was interesting, you know, in talking with Eric Loomis from Lawyers Guns Money blog about Theodore Roosevelt and how, you know, Karl Rove said that it really started with him, all of the downward, all the bad stuff for us, started with Roosevelt, the trust buster, you know, setting up those antitrust laws. How dare he? Maybe we need somebody to enforce those. They're still on the books. We just haven't used them. Maybe we should get a, you know, one of those dusters and dust some books off and maybe reread those. Because we're ending up with bigger and bigger and bigger, not American companies, global companies. And we're no longer going to be countries at some point. We're going to be corporations. Hi, I'm from the corporation of ABC. How are you today? I mean, doesn't that scare you? You know, they keep talking about, well, you know, we worry about the Chinese. I'm worried about GE. I'm worried about Boeing. I'm worried about these big corporations taking over. I'm worried about the media conglomerates. The people who spin the message, the people who are in our ear, in our face, constantly advertising to us all the time. That's what I'm afraid of.
And the irony is, Rick, those who preach about the evils of government are the same people who are pushing this corporatocracy on us. That's the irony.
Yeah, you look at the whole healthcare discussion. The whole discussion on healthcare really was co-opted by the right-wing media. They did a great job. You got to give them credit. They did a great job scaring the hell out of Granny. They did a great job of, oh, this is communism. It's the end of our civilization. And now you've got states around the country who are doing some dumb things, like New Jersey. New Jersey wants to make it a crime to enforce the federal health care laws. In fact, you in the private sector, you could face a $1,000 fine and up to 5 years in jail. If you're a state worker, it'd be a $500 fine and a 2-year prison term. If this woman from Sussex County gets her way, her name is Allison Little McHose. Her name is actually McHose. if she gets her way, it's a crime. It is a crime for the state to enforce the federal law. I doubt it's going to pass, but you know this is where these T-Twizzlers are thinking. Because, you know, we don't want any of that socialism. We don't want health care for those poor people. What we want is we want people like the guy who robbed a bank in North Carolina to get health care. That's what we want. We want desperate people. We want people who are going to put off health care. We're going to want people who, you know, when that thing starts growing on their side, they just hope it goes away. Or like the guy who had the wart on his finger, took out a gun, and, oh, I can shoot the wart off. Shot off his entire finger. All because we can't simply go to the doctor and say, doctor, I got this problem. Because we don't have the money. And somebody sent me an email the other day. That, you know, again, one of these doctors down in the South saying, you know, I just dealt with a person who had tattoos and gold teeth and, you know, they were smoking, you know, multiple packs of cigarettes, you know, talking about them drinking beer, and they had a Medicaid card. But they don't deserve that. And, you know, I can pick one person out of any situation and demagogue it to death. This isn't about them. That isn't about that one person. If there's someone cheating the system, we will find them. At the end of the day, it's about having a safety net where people aren't robbing banks to go to jail. Because think about this. This guy just wanted to get health care. He's now going to be in jail. $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year to hold this guy in jail. Not to mention the entire court process. The court-appointed lawyer, the prosecution, the judges, all of this money, the taxpayer dollars going into the system just because this guy needed health care. How insane is that? But that's our system. And I guess Winston Churchill was right. Americans always do the right thing after doing everything else first. And I guess we're in the process of doing everything else first right now, because you look at that scenario, and I just don't see it as the right thing. But if you look at this bill, it basically renders the health care law null and void in New Jersey, basically saying we're not going. And this is New Jersey, a state where, you know, the majority Democrats. I mean, it's amazing to me. Maybe we should all move to Vermont. They're the only state I think that's got it right. Start setting up a system where we make sure that everybody's covered. So there are no free riders. The system works for everybody. Maybe I just live in a pie in the sky world. Maybe we could have coloring books. We can get, you know, coloring books where everybody's wonderful. They're not sick. And they don't have to rob banks to get health care. We can have coloring books, just like Fracasaurus. I wonder how much they paid in consulting fees and design and all of that. How much money they threw into coming out with this coloring book to propagandize to 9-year-olds. I just wonder, you know, because I'm sure there had to be some vice presidents involved in this, and there had to be a focus team, and there had to be, you know, a whole bunch of researchers, and had to be custom tailored to the 9-year-old brain, because the 9-year-old is, you know, a little different than the 10-year-old, of course, so we have to make sure that the pages are. I wonder how much money. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Jeff Holtzman from Talk Radio News Service. Back after this.
Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our good friend Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service. Jeff, what's going on in D.C. tonight?
Hey, Rick. Well, I think, as you probably saw, the president made a big announcement tonight regarding his strategy going forward in Afghanistan. The president announced that he would like to draw down 10,000 U.S. troops from Afghanistan by the end of this year, and then an additional 23,000 troops sometime next year, bringing the total troops, the total amount of troops drawn down to 33,000 by the end of next September. So the U.S. currently has about 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. Of course, the president signed off on the Afghan surge in December 2009, which sent 30,000 troops to Afghanistan, bringing that total to 100,000. It looks like he's now ready to pull those troops out. And so when it's all said and done, by the end of next September, the U.S. will have about 67,000 troops remaining in Afghanistan.
Which is, if I understand, double what was in Afghanistan when he took office.
Well, it's not quite double, but it's certainly more than what he had in Afghanistan. The president has obviously slowly added troops, throughout his time in office. And of course, the 100,000 that we currently have there, you know, is almost as many as the U.S. had in Iraq during the height of the Iraq War. The U.S. had about 145,000 in Iraq, and since Obama took office, the U.S. has removed about 100,000 from Iraq. So we still have about 45,000 troops in Iraq. And then, of course, you have to realize the U.S. also has about 50,000 troops stationed in Germany, about 36,000 stationed in Japan, and, of course, almost 30,000, I believe it's about 28,000 stationed in Korea. And then, of course, we're involved in the Libya campaign against Muammar Gaddafi, although we don't have troops on the ground. And the president touched upon Iraq and Libya during his 13-minute speech tonight. He reminded that he's, you know, withdrawn troops from Iraq. He made it a point to say that he did not put boots on the ground in Libya. And one of the things that he said towards the end of the speech that I think really resonated with a lot of people is he said, instead of building Afghanistan, it's time to focus on building America. And that's a quote that has gotten a lot of traction with people who saw the speech.
Yeah, it grabbed me as well. But, you know, the quote that caught me was almost right at the beginning.
That is the responsibility of the Afghan government, which must step up its ability to protect its people and move from an economy shaped by war to one that can sustain a lasting peace.
You know, I listen to that and I go, well, one, how do we get there? And two, maybe we should be talking about moving away from a war economy.
Yeah, I think that there's been a lot of weariness growing in the past couple months regarding the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. And I think for a couple reasons. First of all, it seems as though that the U.S., you know, we have made some gains against the Taliban in Afghanistan, but there's recent news that the Taliban was able to regain footing in one of the small villages in southeast Afghanistan that we had originally pushed them from. So it seems to be a situation in which we're making gains, but to quote General Petraeus, they're fragile and reversible, and I think a lot of people understand that we have yet to deal the death blow to the Taliban, and they just seem to keep hanging around, and a lot of people are looking at that, and they're looking at the fact that it's costing, you know, upwards of $120 billion a year to operate this war, and they're saying, is it worth it? And I think the president is hearing that, and it's not just from folks on the left, it's from folks on the right, too, who are saying maybe it's time to rethink this strategy. Now, it's going to be interesting because Petraeus himself is set to testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee tomorrow, I should say, for his confirmation hearing. Of course, he's, you know, the president nominated him to become the next CIA director, and I'm sure he'll face questions. Hillary Clinton will also be on the Hill to testify tomorrow before that same committee. And Hillary Clinton is somebody who I think is only reluctantly embracing this strategy to draw down troops in Afghanistan if what I'm hearing out of the White House is correct.
Yeah, I keep thinking about the Russians in the 80s. And I keep going back to 17 years they were in Afghanistan. And what did they do?
Sure, and obviously, a lot of people point to that. A lot of people point to the fact that the British occupied Afghanistan for many, many years before eventually fleeing Afghanistan without getting the results that they wanted. And some people look at Afghanistan as a Central Asian landlocked country and say that it's just impossible to win there. And, you know, I would say, just taking my reporter cap off here for a second, that I don't think that we've dealt the death knell to the Taliban at this point. And you know, this is our 10th year in Afghanistan, which, you know, if you keep track of it, it's longer officially than the Vietnam War, which a lot of people, you know, have called one of the worst wars that we've ever been in and note it for its length and scope. And so I think that it's just we're at a situation where you've either got to stay and hope that the surge of troops can start really making lightning-quick momentum and lightning-quick gains, and if not, then rethink the strategy. I think that's what President Obama is doing right now. And the president also reminded during his speech that, you know, while he'll withdraw about 33,000 troops by next September, that's just the start. He plans on withdrawing more troops after that because the goal still remains to be able to turn security forces over to the Afghan security forces in 2014.
Yeah, but here you got a president there, Karzai, who's calling you occupiers. Well, you know, why do you want to be in a country when you got the head guy there, the mayor of Kabul, if you will, calling you an occupier? Kind of makes you wonder. Jeff Holtzman, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much for the report from D.C.
I appreciate it, Rick. Thanks.
All right, now to find out what we got going on across the street, what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Thanks, Rick. An article by Jan Murray on the Patriot News concerning the state employee unions and Governor Tom Corbett administration. They both remain optimistic that labor agreements are possibly within reach. We had a gentleman on from SEIU, and according to him, they have made some progress. However, they got some important things to iron out, and they will be back in negotiations tomorrow. Negotiations between the governors, labor negotiations, two of the largest state employee unions, will continue into this evening. Heading into another bargaining session following 7 hours of negotiations today, Dave Fillman, who is the executive director of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Council 13, said the talks are now down to finding common ground on wages and health care. He declined to discuss specifics of how any of the other issues were resolved during a marathon negotiating session that began on Monday.
You know, at the end of the day, it's going to come down to man-hour costs. At the end of the day, you know, this is going to come down to how much money is it going to cost me, as all of these things do. There's some negotiation to be done around the edges, but at the end of the day, this governor is going to try and extract as much from those workers, going to try and put the screws on them as much as possible. To make himself look better, so that he can go to his governor, the Republican Governors Association, and pump his chest out and say, look what I did to those working people.
Well, our friend Ken Jasper from SEI pretty much said the same thing. It's tough negotiation. Some of the things are relatively easy, but some of the big issues they're. It's going to be tough sledding. I think the governor is going to play hardball.
It comes down to dollars and cents, and it comes down to they've created this crisis. And you look, it's not just here in Pennsylvania; it's across the country through their anti-tax policies, through their insane. We need to give away. Think about this for a second. We're going to slash tax rates. We're going to keep cutting tax rates for the very wealthy. So we have less revenue coming in, but we're going to give out boatloads of money to corporations in the hopes that, that they're going to create jobs. It hasn't happened. So what we've done is we've cut our coffers. We've ended the money coming in, and we've handed out money in the hopes that more money will come in. Hasn't happened. So what have we done? We've drained our coffers, and we've created a crisis. We've allowed them to put us in a crisis that now they want to be bailed out by the workers. That's what this is. Simple.
No, I agree with you, Rick. Another crisis around Harrisburg, which seems to be heating up, is the problem with the city. What's going to happen? Well, it's starting to come down to the nitty-gritty. Senator Pakola has a bill out there which would force Act 47 plan on Harrisburg by a 9-5 party line vote. The Senate Community Economic and Recreational Department Committee passed Senator Pakola's bill to force implementation of Harrisburg's Act 47 plan. The committee action set the stage for a vote on the Senate floor as early as Friday and possibly House consideration next week. The bill would call for an appointment of state County Management Board with full powers to implement Harrisburg's Act 47 plan if city officials do not accept or cannot reach an agreement on an alternative that is acceptable to the corporate administration. Pakola, a Republican from Susquehanna Township, told committee members the bill must be fast-tracked so that, assuming passage, it can take effect before a working majority in the city council has a chance to reject the proposed recovery plan filed for municipal bankruptcy. That, he said, would be disastrous for Harrisburg and its residents and municipalities across the state that would likely face more limited or costly access to credit markets going forward. But it would also protect the bondholders, and that's something.
How dare you? How
we haven't talked
dare
anything
you?
About. Jane Orey, who is the committee chairwoman from Erie, said this, and this is a quote. I understand everybody's reluctance to entertain this legislation, which essentially does encroach on a municipality's sovereignty. And we would not be doing this if we had any other choice. But we cannot sit idly by and watch this city council and this mayor march towards disaster. So things are heating up, and it looks like next week it's going to play out. Whatever happens, Rick, it's going to be ugly. It's going to be ugly, and I hope for the sake of the workers that they're not asked to bear too much of that burden. Privatization. The Republicans are talking about privatizing Amtrak. A good article in the AFL-CIO website. And what the labor would like you to do is absolutely tomorrow contact your congressman. Tell them that privatization would destroy a lot of jobs. The irony is, Rick, right now, from what I understand, according to the article, Amtrak right now financially is probably as good a shape as it's been for a while. And to privatize it now would basically result in destroying Amtrak. And I believe that's what they want. And then they want to try to privatize it. And here's the key thing, and I think you mentioned in the show earlier, there is not one nation that has a good rail system that doesn't incorporate a lot of government money. And it's not going to, privatization will not work in this country.
No, and that's the whole point. They don't want it to work. They want to make sure that it fails so that you're stuck on the oil, you're stuck on the automobile, you have no option, so they can keep you under their thumb with high gas prices. That's what this is about. That's what it's always been about.
Well, they mentioned also Great Britain. You had mentioned earlier about how Germany has such a good rail system. Well, they tried privatization in Great Britain. The fares went up, service and safety deteriorated, and passengers and employees died in large numbers due to lack of minimum safety standards.
Well, because you start cutting corners.
Absolutely.
Oh, we've got to make money, got to make money.
Absolutely.
And you've got this, instead of providing a service and moving people and doing those things, we're now conscious about, we need to make money, we need to make profit, we've got to pay the shareholders. Shareholders are bearing down on us. No one's going to invest in our company. It's not about that. It's about a public service. And we don't have that mentality in this country. I don't know if we ever will. Maybe $10 a gallon. Maybe.
One last report, Rick. Jan Murphy from the Patriot News. House Education Committee has canceled a hearing on school vouchers and charter school reform. House Democrats succeeded in stopping a House Education Committee from holding a public hearing on education reform proposals after Democrats argued the meeting had not been advertised according to House rules. Sounds a little bit like Wisconsin. The meeting was intended to be a discussion of school vouchers, House Bill 1708 and House Bill 1678 and charter school reform legislation introduced in the House. Also over in the Senate, a school voucher bill that had been advancing has stalled over the past month due to its failure to garner enough votes to ensure passage in House. Some of these, it's good developments on that front, so it looks like some of these anti-labor legislation has stalled, and that's good news, at least for the moment.
So we're going to take a quick break, right back after this, to wrap things up.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one? Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well. Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211. How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave? Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can
literally fix anything, that's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Your working class radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left. Rich and a farmer. Father shot, left a cameo. Blue dental, head is vape.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Missed any portion of the program, just go to our website and download our podcast there for your entertainment, your convenience, your enjoyment. Tomorrow, we're going to be at the big rally starting at 9:15, 319 Market Street down here in Harrisburg in front of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO building. 319 Market Street. They're going to start their march towards the Harrisburg Hilton there at 9:15. Are going to have a rally in front of the Hilton to let the shareholders of Rite Aid know that, you know, don't balance your books on our backs, what the workers are saying. You know, treat their workers right. Maybe stop giving such big golden parachutes. Maybe stop taking care of the CEOs. Maybe start taking care of the workers. Maybe the people who make you your profit, maybe the people who make Rite Aid the company that it is. So we hope we'll see you there. I will be there at 9:15 to participate, and I hope you will be too. I got an email during the break from William who says, "Welcome to Rollerball." And, you know, immediately I get that. You know, everyone please stand. Please stand. Please. Stand. For the playing of our corporate hymn. Again, you know, it's all about corporatization, man. It's all about, it's no longer about nations. It's about corporations. And there's a quote that always pops into my head. One of the characters who was on the team with Jonathan was talking to him, said, you know, what do you want books for? Look, Johnny, you want to learn something? Just go get a corporate teacher, get them to come and teach you. Use your privilege card. I mean, I listen to that, and I remember that, and go, you know, is that where we're heading? Got your bonus card. Every corporation we go into, man, we got to get our bonus card. We got to get our privilege points. Just insane. They are taking over. They are absolutely taking over. In fact, taking over so much so that they're eating each other. You look at Best Buy. They have sent a cease and desist letter to the folks over at Newegg.com. One of these websites that, sells computer products. And a real good place for stuff. I think I got my laptop from there. Not an endorsement, and I'm just saying, you know, that's where I got it from. But they've sent this cease and desist letter over the advertising campaign that Newegg was doing with their advertising slogan of Get Your Geek On. I guess Best Buy was unhappy because it sounds like the Geek Squad. Which, you know, again, I had to do a little bit of work for me as well. Turns out Best Buy has copyright claims to the word geek. I did not know that. So, kind of interesting. I can no longer call you geek, I guess, because it's copywritten. Just like Sarah Palin and Bristol Palin. They have trademark. Isn't that beautiful? I gotta love it. Absolutely gotta love that. A story that came out of, one of these Reuters stories that grabbed my attention. And this is where, some of me goes, do we really need all this research? Down in Texas, the University of Texas came out with a report, this study that says it proves what single men have known for a long time, that chicks dig hot cars. Reuters reports Men who wear expensive clothes and drive flashy cars are more successful at having flings and staying single than their financially conservative partners, according to the University of Texas at San Antonio. And while it's not exactly groundbreaking information that some women are more likely to go from the bar with a guy with a Porsche than a Geo, the project found the phenomenon is less about gold digging and more about signals. That's what the Dr. Jill Sunday told Reuters. She was one of the people there with the study. And I go, you know, really? And if you listen to her take on it, she says by engaging in splashy personal spending, men are sending a signal to women that they want short-term relationships. Much like a peacock trying to woo a mating partner uses wasteful and elaborate displays. Basically, they're just trying to convince a female that, hey, if you're looking for jeans, I've got the best jeans, so you should choose me. Women who pick up on that signal, respond to it positively, are the kind that go after that. The other ones, well, they're looking for marriage. Again, you know, I look at these studies and go, duh, you had to spend money on this? Someone got a doctorate over this? Don't know. Here's where I would like to be. This, you know, early summer in Portland, you got cloudy skies, threatened a little bit of rain, temperatures, you know, not so good. But you had thousands of naked bicyclists who gathered near the city's waterfront in a clothing-free ride. It's the Portland version of the World Naked Bike Ride. And you got a whole bunch of naked people riding their bikes. I think I would like to see that. I don't get to see things like that very often. But then again, I'm twisted. I wouldn't be riding my bike naked, but, you know, some people would. God bless them. Here's an interesting story. Artificial labs have grown meat. It requires about 96% less greenhouse gas emissions than raising cattle, according to this new study. If produced on a large scale, scientists say it could ease deforestation and pressure on food and water supplies, ensuring more people are eating well, and abate the concerns of animal rights activists everywhere. They added the cultured meat would only require about 1% of the land space needed for cattle and about 4% of the water. Currently, meat production is the number one source of human-generated greenhouse gas emissions, pumping out more pollutants each year than all other sources combined. So we're now making meat in a laboratory. If genetically modified crops didn't bother you before, what do you think about LC being made in a petri dish? I don't know. I don't know that I'm so thrilled with this. But they claim it cuts down on greenhouse gases. Good for them. Another immigration law. Georgia has one of the toughest now, they say. Recently just passed. The federal judge heard some arguments yesterday brought by taxi cab drivers. This is something I had not thought of. But the taxi cab companies are going, hey, wait a minute. This new law is going to make the taxi drivers look at people's immigration status. So if you're in Georgia and you need to get a taxi cab somewhere, they need to check your papers. You've got taxi cab drivers checking your papers because it's a crime to transport any undocumented immigrants, according to the Georgia law. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. Anyway, I want to thank everyone for being here tonight, especially our guests, our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson, and Eric Loomis, editor there over at lawyersgunsmoneyblog.com, and also Ken Jasper, who came to talk to us a little bit about the contract negotiations going on. Of course, thank you for being here. If you missed any portion of the program, you can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com, or you can just check out our website there and download our podcast, posted for your convenience, posted for your entertainment and your enjoyment. And soon we will have the Stitcher app. I think it's already up and running. So you can go to Stitcher.com on your smartphone and take us on the go. Have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow morning, 9:15, 319 Market Street, and back here again, 9 to midnight. Have a great night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's color of life, tide of flood beneath, put our sway, imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USP.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
They're stealing down on Wall Street and in Washington, too.